Welcome, everyone, to episode 420 of Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
The streak just keeps going. Mind-boggling.
Two in a row, baby. James Jones is here. His streak is much, much, much longer than that.
It's almost like John has accomplishments.
Yeah.
I'll take anything I can get.
And, of course, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Yeah, no one even notices if I'm gone or not.
You're here, buddy.
You're here an awful lot, buddy. All right. Well, we have an exciting show for you this week. Most notably, coming up a little bit later, we're finally going to do our retroactive feature on Pokemon the Trading Card Game. It has been a lot of fun to play this game and see everyone playing along and hear all their thoughts on it. It has certainly been divisive and interesting. And I think a game that a lot of people's opinion on it has evolved over time as they learn more about it and play more of it. So we'll devote a large chunk of the episode to talking about that and reading some of the comments from our forum thread. But first, we have new business, and I have to say it's a kind of an odd crop of things to talk about this week on new business. My excuse is House of Cards, among other things, but anyway, we're going to throw some things out there and see what sticks, and hopefully you'll find that it's interesting. As usual, Guillaume is the most on topic, and so I asked him to go first.
Yeah, so Karen and I have finished Kirby's Rainbow Curse, and I feel like, well, you know, my thoughts about the game have evolved a little just because of the way that, well, okay, like the game is very, very short. So when I said last week that as early as the third world, you're in the air and it's really difficult, turns out that that's about like the halfway point of the game. So I was actually both like it was early and it was also very far into the game. And unfortunately, there is truth to the criticism that the game doesn't really do much to vary the gameplay or to introduce new types of challenges or things like that. Like, there's kind of a dearth of new ideas, and that's unfortunate. Actually, all the cool new ideas that they had, they all put in the seventh and final world, and that's a little bit too late, you know? And I would have appreciated getting more of some of those new types of levels, but you just get the one, and that's it. Once you finish the main quest, you get a bunch of challenge stages, but those are basically finish these four really short challenges in 15 seconds each, and you nab a medal. Like, it's not a full stage; it's just this kind of challenge room where you need to get Kirby to grab this this treasure chest as fast as you can. But yeah, so it's really sad though, because the new ideas that they do have are pretty cool. Like that one stage in the seventh world is I'm gonna spoil it. At some point you get to control two Kirbys at the same time, and it's just cool that most of the level they just confine each Kirby to its own path. Like there's a kind of a tunnel where he splits up into two, and then they both are in like the top and the bottom. They each are in the top and bottom part of the stage of the level of the screen. And so like one has to open up a switch so that the other can progress further and touch a switch, and you know, and so on. But eventually the two Kirbys get back together on the same screen, and then you can do some really cool stuff, and it's almost like playing a weird kind of pool, like of billiards, because like you send one Kirby into the other Kirby, and then that Kirby just goes flying into everything and bounces everywhere. And I could easily imagine Nintendo just iterating on this idea or expanding upon it and having, instead of just the regular side-scrolling levels that they have the whole game, like they could have done some cool stuff, like, you know, like a billiards thing or like a pinball type of stage.
Well, I like the idea of your lines being used by more than one Kirby, because then if you're trying to get them to go two places at once, that's going to, you know, increase the dexterity challenge of drawing the lines exactly where you want them to go and of getting mm-hmm. all the angles and everything right. I mean, I'm sure they've done that in Kirby's Pinball, and I'm sure they did it in What's the weird golf?
The Black Ball? No. Dream Course?
I can't think of it. Dream Course. Yes, yeah. Thank you. And of course, they did multiple Kirbys in Mass Attack. But it, you know, the physics of the rolling ball Kirby that's in Canvas Curse and Rainbow Curse seems like it would be very well suited to having multiples up there on the screen. And you still have really just the one single touch input device of the touch screen to try to manage multiples, and they're rolling all over the place and going where you don't want them to. Maybe that's just too hard to base a game or even an entire mode around it, but that seems,
well, I could easily see it as, you know, post-credit worlds or something like that. Like
or
Nintendo
DLC?
Never.
DLC?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know how DLC would be popular for this game, really. Like, I think mostly kids are going to be playing it, and I don't know if the parents are going to, you know, want to enter their credit card information to go download some more stages, it seems like.
Well, especially with the game's rep is, God, this game is short.
Right. Right. Some people would feel jilted for sure. But yeah, so it was enjoyable enough. Like, don't get me wrong. If you want to be playing a 2015 Nintendo game on the Wii U, you don't have a lot of choices. And this is not...
Game of the year!
Yeah, so far. This is not a terrible game. Like, it's perfectly serviceable and it looks really awesome. But, you know, I asked Karen what she thought about it, and she thought it was frustrating. She doesn't have Canvas Curse as a point of reference because she hasn't played it, but she likened it to the train track laying stages of Kirby's Epic Yarn and said that those were bullshit and that this game is like a whole game out of that, except with better controls because you're not using cursor, you're not using the Wii Remote pointer, you know? And she's also currently playing Kirby Triple Deluxe, and she's enjoying that way more. Personally, like, I'm just kind of happy to have had another co-op experience on the Wii U, because they're really not as plentiful as they should be. Just co-op games in general. I don't know if there used to be more of those on Super Nintendo or what, but I feel like I'm always struggling to find something new to play. And even though I've been subscribing to PlayStation Plus for a while, like, they never seem to get to give that many co-op games. I don't know what the situation is. Like, maybe the PlayStation doesn't even have that many co-op games either, because at this point people expect to be playing online, and developers have started kind of letting you know, couch co-op fall on the wayside.
I think there's a lot of couch co-op stuff on PS4. I mean, it's almost all independent games.
Right.
But there are lots of them available, and more coming.
Right. Well, there's also independent games coming to the Wii U, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed that there's going to be more co-op experiences. One final thing about Kirby. I've been shamed anonymously by the RFN podcast Twitter feed for using the word charming too often, but Kirby is fucking charming. And one of the charming things
about... Taking a shot!
Kirby's Rainbow Curse is that, you know, remember back when games had manuals, and not just like manuals, but manuals with plenty of useless info in them. Like, they would describe the enemies for you. The Mario manual would tell you, okay, so this guy is named Lakitu, and here's what he's like, you know, if you weren't
meeting. What's his motivation?
Right, exactly. So all the unlockables in this game, when you collect the chests, are either like music tracks that you can listen to, or these 3D models of the enemies that you can look at, and also a short description. And they're fucking hilarious. They're really, really fun. Well, maybe that's overstating. Like, every time I'm chuckling, like, I'm not laughing my ass off, but I'm chuckling, and I'm also pitying the poor bastards, because every time it seems like every enemy description is like, oh, this guy, like, sure, like, he's patrolling for you know, the big boss, but his heart is not really in it, and he's thinking of quitting and dreads the conversation he's gonna have with his coworkers, like, things like that. It's ridiculous. It's absurd, and they're all pathetic, and I don't know. It's cute. It's charming. I'm saying it again.
There's another shot.
So now that we finished this co-op game, I'm, again, looking forward to the next co-op experience. Another co-op game that I've been playing, though, is, Kirby Four Swords. Zelda Four Swords, the anniversary version that came out on DSiWare for free for a while, actually came out for free, like, in two separate instances, and then it left the DSiWare shop again, or the eShop again.
Yeah, they've never sold it. I think it's only been given away for free during promotional periods, right. One of which was after the 3DS came out. So right. Even if you never owned a DSi, you could still get it on your right. 3DS through the eShop if you if you had one at that time.
Right. So I've got like a DSi XL that I still haven't transferred the software from, because I've got a copy of Four Swords on there, and if I were to transfer that stuff onto my 3DS, I would lose a copy, a precious, precious copy of Four Swords. And I don't want to do that. Even though there's very little chance that at some point I'm going to have a guest and like, hey, here, like, let's play Four Swords. And like, that's probably never going to happen, but I just don't want to get rid of that precious, precious copy. Fortunately, Karen has on her 3DS also a copy of Four Swords. So we've been playing two-player. And it's really, really fun. We've actually been going through the game cooperatively instead of trying to be dicks to one another. And so that's a very, very different play style than what
yes.
I had experienced beforehand. Like, I had played Four Swords Adventure on the GameCube with a bunch of people from the internet, from Negative World, when we had that meetup. And it was just cutthroat. Right.
Yeah.
In this case,
well, that game even has a deathmatch mode.
Right.
I mean, it's designed to make you do as terrible a thing as you can to other people.
Right.
Like, it is built to make you, well, to just ruin relationships.
Yeah, James, I don't remember if you were there, but we had a couple of, at least one or two years at E3 of playing Four Swords Adventures, like four player, five player, I guess four, and, that was insanely fun. It's kind of like Crystal Chronicles, Final Fantasy, in that it's kind of it's painful to get all the gear together and the right people. Mm-hmm. But if you can do it, it's a pretty amazing experience. And no one really talks about Four Swords Adventures. You know, it's not really part of the Zelda timeline or anything like that, and it's not a marquee game in this series. But I think it's so original and different and amazingly fun.
It still bums me out that game, the version of the game we got in the West, just they just gutted out all that other stuff from it, from the Japanese version.
Right, a whole third of the disc, right?
They took out one mode, which was Tetris Trackers, and I don't believe that was really one of the best parts of the game, and it's certainly not a third of the game. I mean, the main adventure mode is far and away the
but
majority
of
the game.
It's still a
bonus mode.
It's still a very weird thing for Nintendo. It's not something they would normally do.
It was because of the voice generation system at the time. They didn't have it working in English. It had a Tomodachi style, very limited, but you in Japanese you could put in your name in Japanese characters, and then the game would pronounce that as like a cue for, hey, now it's your turn to do something. You know, I've never actually played that version, obviously, but but yeah, so it was just going to be really difficult to localize that, and so they decided to take it out. But again, it was a fairly small part of the game, so right. I don't want to overblow the importance of that.
Right. Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I don't get why Nintendo just doesn't put Four Swords Anniversary on the eShop and sell it, because the fewer copies there are out there, the less chances anyone has of playing this game the way it's meant to be played, right? With four players. Right. It's in the fucking title. So they should really make it widely available.
Doesn't even have the licensing issues of like Pac-Man Versus.
No, and this version, like, it works. It just works. It's probably the version that requires the less hardware just because everything is wireless. Like, it's included mm-hmm. in the 3DS or the DS hardware, right? Like, you can just connect with someone else and you're done. So it's really, maybe it's not the best version of that game. I've heard, like, I haven't played the GameCube version enough to, you know the subtle differences between all the versions, but a lot of people who have played more the GameCube version say that this one is lacking in some ways, but it's still very, very fun. And even playing it with only one other player, It's a blast. And
I think I can clear that up for you a little bit, because this it is a confusing situation. But Four Swords Anniversary, the one that you're playing, mm-hmm. is an update to the original Four Swords, which was a multiplayer only Zelda game that was packaged with the remake of A Link to the Past on GBA.
Right.
So this the version you're playing is I think it has graphical updates and maybe some tweaks to the levels. It's not entirely new, but it's kind of just it's an update. And of course, it supports wireless, which is the important thing. Mm-hmm. And it was free. But anyway, so it was kind of a supplementary mode to the GBA conversion of A Link to the Past. And then a few years after that came out, Nintendo made the GameCube game, which is a completely separate affair, called Four Swords Adventures. And that actually looks like a kind of a ROM hack version of A Link to the Past. So it's done with that graphical style and a lot of the enemies and music and things like that. It's not a complete ripoff. I mean, they did add a lot of new things to it as well. But it looks like a four-player version of A Link to the Past.
Nice.
Whereas the original Four Swords and Four Swords Anniversary look more like Link's Awakening. They're more
actually
of that.
Yeah, it looks more like Minish Cap. I think that Link's sprite is straight out of Minish Cap. And there is some Wind Waker stuff in this version, because the what are they called, the Moblins, the the guys that in the Forsaken Fortress at the beginning of Wind Waker, when you're trying to stay away from, not to be seen by
Moblins or Bokoblins or whatever they changed it to.
Right, so like they're really huge and they've got this kind of spear, and it's really weird, like seeing that represented in 2D, it doesn't quite work because they're so tall and like so much taller than they are, you know, wide, and everything in Zelda games usually is so squat, you know, it's so square because you have that view that's slightly, you know, angled up. So I find it kind of weird, like the sprites look a little bit weird, but also the collision detection. I'm never sure like where I'm supposed to be hitting them with a sword. They seem to be blocking me, but I can't really tell what's going on. But thankfully, those enemies don't pop up too often. One of the biggest, you know, like it's really a fun version, but it seems very, very short. Like you clear three areas, and once you do, like you've gotten three keys from it, and then you have access to the last stage. But then what the manual, the e-manual in the game doesn't tell you is that you're supposed to go through those stages again, and the requirement is that you're supposed to get more rupees. If together, cooperatively, like if you can amass 3,000 rupees, then you get a golden key when you finish the level. And then you can, so you do that again in those three levels, and then you can again fight the last boss. And once you've done that, and not earlier, then you can go back into levels again and gain 5,000 rupees, and then you go through the game one last time. You can't skip ahead, like you can't just get 5,000 rupees the first time and just finish a game the first time. And none of this is explained. Like I had to get to an FAQ to know exactly why is it that there's like these three doors in this last palace and I can only ever enter the first one. Eventually I got tired of, you know, just bumping in the dark, and I looked at an FAQ and finally found the answer.
Is the boss different depending on which key that you have?
I'm really hoping that for the third time he's going to be, but for the second time, like we just finished it and it was mostly the same. Maybe the levels themselves were slightly more difficult just because there seemed to be more enemies. There were more rupees to collect and there were more, I don't know, the enemies seemed to hit harder. So I'm guessing the third time is going to be even harder. And then, yeah, we'll see. One thing, like the so it looks like each level has several variations and it's just random which one you're going to get. So that helps with the replay value. Like it's going to be the same types of environments, but the level layouts are going to be different. And yeah, you can unlock some special stages as well when you go through. Like there's some levels that look more like Link to the Past. Actually, like it looks exactly like the entrance to the Hyrule Castle in Link to the Past. And that's, you know, nostalgic and pretty cool.
So if the two of you are really having such a great time with Four Swords Anniversary, if you've never played the GameCube game, Four Swords Adventure, I played a little bit of it. The adventure, the main adventure mode of that is much longer than the
handheld game.
It is I think it's even done like world 1-1 up through like world 8-4 or something like that. I mean, it's set level by level, which is very weird for a Zelda game, but it has a ton of levels and a lot of them are bigger and I think probably more interesting than the ones in Anniversary or the original Four Swords. So yeah, you can probably find that for cheap. If you can find the damn GBA link cables to play it, I think you'll have a great time with it.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking about it because this is pretty fun. And the one time that I played the GameCube game, you know, it was someone else's equipment and setup. So, you know, that made it easier and at no cost to me. but this time I did find a used game store where they had like a whole plastic bag of Odama, mics for $2 each. I'm guessing that if I'm going to find GBA cables, that's a good place to go.
They're dirt cheap online.
Okay. So, but sometimes less so in Canada. We'll see. But yeah, maybe I'll drop by there and get a second cheap GBA and some cables. And then I'm set to go.
Yeah. I bet you would find that very worthwhile.
Nice.
So, Guy, I know you have one more thing to talk about. Why don't we come back around and do that if we have time? And for now, we'll move on to James and whatever weird crap he's been playing this week.
Look, first off, I don't come in going like, what shit Johnny's been playing this week? What a fucking waste of time.
Here we go.
I don't go on. Why the fuck do we even have John on the show? Everything he says is just garbage.
What weird Atlas game is James playing this week?
James, didn't you tell us before the show that this might be the first time anyone has ever talked about this game on
the
podcast?
That doesn't mean it's crap. That just means it's not well
known. It's a precious gem.
It is. It's an experience right here.
I mean, there's not.
I can't say definitively
there's not like an active podcast that just covers Nippon Ichi software, but I doubt it. I mean, the Disgaea podcast, possibly, but. This isn't a Disgaea game, although it's obviously based in-universe. This game is the PS2. I'm not going to use the word classic because I hadn't even heard of it before this one. Let me make sure I get the full name correct. Soul Nomad and the World Eaters, which is a hell of a name. And it is entirely the product of just bizarro localization that has taken hold in this game. This is a... take a pause for a second. Most of the games that are kind of set in this Disgaea universe, even if they're not Disgaea games, are sort of your Final Fantasy Tactics, Tactics Ogre. I'm trying to remember what the other series that's kind of like that.
Shining Force.
Yeah, to an extent. Style of, you know, tactical RPG, where it's, you know, it's one character and you just kind of like get high ground and move across individuals and have these one-on-one engagements. This one's a little bit different. It's still turn-based like those games, but the actual structure of unit assembly is closer to an Ogre Battle game, which is how I ended up with this game, because somebody was talking about it on a long-dead message board that I was reading, and I was, what is this? I'll start looking into it.
Wait, do you go to dead message boards and just look at old conversations?
No, I
was... Are you a forum archaeologist?
I can take this story back as far as you want it to go, but I ended up there because I was reading something about Ogre Battle, the original Ogre Battle, talking about the how the class advancement system works in that game, because that's the game I never... I kind of played through it once. I know it's a lot shorter than Ogre Battle 64. I don't really have great memory of it. I just didn't dig into it like I did its sequel. And I was reading something about the class system, and then somebody mentioned this game, kind of in passing. And I went and looked around the message board, and sure enough, there was a whole thread about that game. Because I think I started looking for it because it said, oh yeah, there was a game that somebody mentioned in a thread called, like, World Eaters. And I looked around and found it. So, basically, it is a turn-based, it's kind of a weird hybrid. It's a turn-based tactical RPG, sort of like the games I mentioned, but as opposed to moving around individual units, everybody on the field is essentially a squad. And in a Ogre Battle sort of way, the squad structure influences the flow of battle. In some very distinct ways, this is handled differently. Like I said, it's turn-based, so the movement on the map is very similar to these kinds of this other style, the Final Fantasy Tactics, Tactics Ogre gameplay. So, but there are other little attributes, like you can build units around ranged attacks, and they hit from a distance. Or they're garbage up close, or possibly they can't even defend themselves up close. So there's a little bit of Fire Emblem in there, to an extent. So there's all these weird systems this game has built, you know, developing classes, the different unit formations, like the ground you put them on, because you have these things called rooms. It's fucking weird. I've spent about 9.5 hours with it, and still spend time going to these really old game facts articles where people are like, how the fuck do you play this game? Because there's things, so you build your squad, you can just buy units outright. There are recruiting units, but they're all story based. Most of the units you just buy. You go to a store between battles and say, I would like to buy X number of units in a very disguised sort of way. And you say, I want them to be this level, whatever level you end up, how much you end up paying for them. So I'm building a unit. And at this point, I'm limited to 4, but at the start, I could only have 1, and I was very confused how I make more. So I bought all these units I couldn't use. So I'm trying to figure out all the stuff in this game. I'm enjoying it. There's a certain amount of just, the battles are really small, or they have been to this point. So a lot of times, you know, a battle's over 10, 15 minutes. You can upgrade, like everything has experience, the characters, the team, the equipment, it's just experience systems across the board. It's a very strange game that I have picked up because it's a hybrid of about, I would guess, 5 or 6 different series of strategy and tactics RPGs. So it doesn't always feel like it's working, like, cause there's just so much weird stuff going on, but it sorta is anyway. And I'm enjoying that. What's harder to get by, and you might have guessed from the title and the fact that this is a NISA game, is this localization, and it might not be the localization, it maybe this is the way the game is written, is just fucking bonkers. So characters regularly, first off, the voice acting is atrocious. But it's like people that you've heard before. It's like, it's a voice actors who do other games successfully. But in this one, it's not like they phoned it in. This is what the director told them to do. It's characters yelling lots of insults at each other that you're just like, really? You know, one character calling another character a cow and, you know, retarded and just like, what the fuck is up with this localization? This story's terrible, hence the name, because the name is sort of, literally the enemy of the game is called the World Eaters. They're big dumb statues. It's garbage. But I just enjoy having a game where I have to learn. It's so different, and yet there's so many things that come from other games that I have experience with. It's interesting to see how somebody took lots of individual ideas and sort of blended them together in a way that makes it its own thing. And I've had a good time with that. So, you know, I'm learning strategies for putting together teams, and every battle I'm going out there, I'm doing something new. And that's always just a lot of fun. The game gives you the ability to just keep doing new things until you get something that works. I spent, you know, about an hour today after I got home from work sort of rearranging essentially 3 of my 4 teams from the ground up. And was super excited when I was using the training battles that you can go to and saw we were just wrecking house and gaining levels. I thought, okay, I now have 4 effective teams. I went to the next story mission and got housed. And I was like, all right, well, I need to go back and rework this. And I just enjoy that so much. This opportunity to say, all right, let's try out this combination of things. Oh, that was a disaster. There's so much flexibility in how it works. I just really have enjoyed playing it. And I know that it's hard to describe a game like this, because it's basically saying, oh yeah, it's an Ogre Battle game with Disgaea, character classes, Final Fantasy Tactics, battle flow, and... But, I mean, that's ultimately what it ends up being.
Yeah, you have to have played these 3 relatively obscure sub-series in order to appreciate what it's doing.
Right, yeah, well, like, if someone has played Disgaea, they'll know what you're talking about. But if someone hasn't played Disgaea, I think the better question is, should they play this over Disgaea? Like, is there any reason why a newcomer should start with this one, or instead of going to the much more well-known game from NISA?
Oh, I mean, Disgaea has a. Granted, I'm only about 6 or 7 hours in, but Disgaea has a sort of fetishization of being brutal.
Right.
It will do things occasionally just because I think it's amused at doing them to you.
Right.
This game sometimes does that, whereas Disgaea tends to just enjoy being that game.
Hmm.
The Disgaea games that I've played are certainly better written than this game, which isn't saying a whole hell of a lot.
No, because you've got characters that just keep saying dude all the time, and they're really annoying, so I'm really...
Yeah, but I mean, like, those characters are kind of... I mean, they're deliberately awful.
That like, doesn't like, that doesn't change anything.
I disagree though, because I find it amusing. I find what they're doing with like the printies to be funny because it's so sadly executed that you just kind of sit there and go, "Yep, I'm in this game now."
Hmm.
I would say the reason to play a Disgaea versus this game is that a Disgaea game is going to be way easier to get a hold of. This was a fairly it's a PS2 game that came out 2006. It's, you know, a very, very obscure game in and of itself. There's not, you know, a ton of them out there, and it wasn't cheap. I mean, it was like $20. Whereas you can get a Disgaea game. It may not be the ultimate Disgaea game, and I'm not an expert enough on the series to tell you which one people regard as sort of the pinnacle of that franchise. But, A, you're gonna play games that look a lot better than this one, because this one looks like an up-res Super Nintendo game.
Hmm. But for this conversation, this guy also has the advantage of being available on a Nintendo console. There's a DS one, right?
Yeah, I did not enjoy the DS game that much.
Huh.
There's some technical stuff that makes that game harder.
Hmm.
But I mean, it's fine. You could totally play it. I've talked about it on the show actually. But right.
Long time ago, I think.
Long time ago. If you're gonna go with the Disgaea game and you've got access to a PS3, I would probably say. I don't know if they remade the first one. I know you can get it on PSN, the PlayStation version of it. But the artwork of some of the more recent games looks really good. Whereas the artwork of this game, I actually tweeted my first image of the game for this one. I just said, this is a PS2 game because it was so fucking ridiculous looking how bad it looks. So, I mean, it's just big, ugly China Warrior sprites.
Cool.
Like they're creatively designed, but they're huge.
How dare you invoke the China Warrior?
I mean, they look. I appreciate it. The sprites look a lot better than China Warrior, but like there are these big sprites, and it's a 4x3 game, which on a strategy game can be a real pain in the ass, and it doesn't feel like you can zoom out as far as would be helpful. Like there's all kinds of technical things that a more recent game wouldn't have to deal with. So yeah. in that respect, the Disgaea game is going to have more availability. There was another series from them that I talked about on the show, and I'm blanking on what the name was. It was a Wii game. Phantom Brave, that's it.
Right.
They've made a lot of games like this, and they've all got weird quirks that make each series its own thing. I'm glad I got to experience this weird and, I won't say wonderful, but weird and certainly interesting perspective on, you know, strategy RPGs. And I don't know if I can encourage someone to buy it, because like I said, you'll pay at least $20 for it, but it's,
I think certainly, we're living vicariously through you.
It's
James.
Certainly, you know, it is both exactly what I expected from reading the descriptions, and I am constantly being surprised by what the game does, which is, I guess, to me, that's really enjoyable. So, it is what it is. I mean,
cool. That's a James game.
It's a fucking
yeah.
Game.
I just want to throw a warning out there. Disgaea 2, I think, has. Like if you're expecting a Fire Emblem game, I think you're not gonna find that because I think Disgaea 2 has each item has a 100 floors dungeon
yes.
that you could go through if you're so inclined to improve that item.
Yeah, so in this game, instead of doing that, they do it all your parties are broken up into what are called rooms in your house because you don't actually have people, you have like these possessed dolls that you have captured their spirit. It's fucking weird. And it essentially, you go and you buy rooms for your quote house, which is your party, and you can do those dungeons to level up the room.
Right.
And as you level up the room, you get skill points you can dump into it. The room gains more slots. You can plug more characters in.
So I think it's important that the listeners know what they're possibly getting into. I think if you like that kind of thing, that's awesome. To me, it seems like a chore to play and way too much bullshit.
The Nisa games that use the aesthetic from the Disgaea series and the classes and the character design stuff, those are super hardcore games. Mm-hmm. Like they are not approachable in the way that many other games of the sort of tactical RPG style are approachable.
Right.
They are designed to appeal to the hardest of the hardcore.
Yep.
And they push my limits in a lot of ways. This one, because it's older and because it doesn't do quite so much in the way of just overwhelming brutality, I'm able to sort of mitigate that a little bit.
Okay. Well, that's Soul Nomad for PS2. We know all about it now. I'm going to move on. And, I guess first off, I'll say that, I had an interesting experience, last weekend when I bought a new TV for the first time in 6 years. And, I don't know if you guys have bought new TVs fairly recently, but the process has become somewhat different than it used to be, I think, in that the possible features that you can get are much broader than ever before.
Oh yeah.
And, it's hard to track down, reviews for any given model because there are so, like, the churn in TV models is going so fast now that a lot of times a model will only be out, as far as I can tell, a lot of these are only out for a few months before the same manufacturer will release an update to it that has a different model number.
So it's even more than that. They'll develop independent model numbers for different retailers, so retailers can say, we have the lowest price, and effectively they're almost the exact same model.
That's right. Yeah. So, like, if you go to Best Buy, almost every brand of TV that they carry will have one or two models that it'll say exclusive to Best Buy. And, you maybe don't want to buy that model, because no one else can compete on price for it, you know?
Right.
Right. And also for spare parts, I can't imagine that could cost.
Well, so they're almost always exactly the same TV. It'll be like 1029i74. -BB for Best
right,
Buy.
Right, but my last laptop had like a non-standard fan in it, and that cost me a whole new computer. So I'm kind of wary of that kind of stuff now.
Just get a paper fan. Sure. Just keep fanning it.
TVs in general, I'd say, are more reliable than laptops, considering that you don't carry them around with you and set them on your lap and eat around them. But
sure.
But yeah, that's a fair point as well. So anyway, it took me over a week of pretty heavy research and investigating all over the city to try to find the best store and the best model that had what I wanted. I actually wanted a 3D TV, not desperately, but I thought, 3D, before it started becoming really unpopular, it had actually gotten pretty good. They had gotten to passive 3D where you just needed cheap plastic glasses. They were easy to get more of. And it had a really good viewing angle, and it was easy to get multiple people to sit around and all of them to see it. And I had bought a couple of Blu-rays that supported 3D, and they recently added 3D to the PS4 Blu-ray playback. And anyway, I just thought, oh, that would be cool. And, you know, I've even got a few video games that support 3D output. But it has become so unpopular that although there are a few models that carry it, they either tend to be discontinued models that are very hard to find now. You know, a store might have one or two, but they're basically trying to get rid of them and they're phasing out. Or they're really expensive models where it's just sort of another checkbox they can throw on there to help you justify the $2,000 you're spending on the TV. And that was way over what I wanted to spend. So anyway, I ended up at Costco and ended up kind of unexpectedly buying a 4K TV. And the reason I did it was because, the 4K, there were two Samsungs, 55 inches that I wanted. And the only difference between the two was that one was 4K and it was under $1,000, which I'd never seen a 4K TV of any reasonable size under $1,000 before. And I thought about it and I said, you know, my last TV lasted me 6 years. There's a good chance that the one I'm buying today I'm hopefully going to have it at least 4 or 5 years. And by the time that rolls around, I'll probably be glad that I had 4K for at least 2 or 3 years out of the lifespan of this TV. So it's something that I know is basically useless today, but that's okay. I'm future proofing a little bit, and I was able to do it for what I thought was a reasonable price that I didn't even think was in the realm of possibility. So yeah, I ended up buying a friggin' 4K TV. And I didn't think I was going to be one of the people who owned one of those in the year 2015, but here I am. And I haven't really been able to use it for very much yet. It's only been a few days and I've been busy. I just thought that process was interesting. I'm very excited to play a whole bunch of games on it. And I just unfortunately haven't had time to do it. So maybe I can report back on that a little bit.
How many inches is it, Johnny?
55.
Sweet, sweet.
Yeah, and my previous one was 37. So it's a rather large difference.
It's way better. Way better.
The other question I would ask is, have you ever had a Samsung before?
Yes, actually, I think my last TV was a Samsung or a Panasonic. Okay. Well, it was a Panasonic.
Okay, because that they are, and there are people who will disagree, but I speaking to professionals, they are best of breed. Like there is. Not it. They do the most research. They spend the most money on producing the best TVs, which is why they tend to be the most expensive.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sony's are really good too for particular things.
Yeah.
Actually, what I've heard is that
overpriced in general, but
I've heard that Sony TVs use Samsung screen technology, but then they marry that with Sony's processing. And Sony builds their own chips, and they will add features and do certain things to make them perform better. But Sony's are also significantly more expensive than just about any other brand.
Yep.
I learned a whole lot about the modern state of TVs in the past few years. Some of the companies that I would have considered 4 or 5 years ago basically don't exist anymore, or they're not really considered high tier anymore.
Right.
The Samsung had good reviews. But one thing I did want to touch on is that I had started reading a little bit about input lag. And
yes.
That was a concern. It seemed to be something I should be concerned about and something that I should make sure was okay before I bought a TV. And there's a website called displaylag.com, which is probably the best that I've found for actually providing hard information about this. They do their own independent testing on TV models, and they tell you what the input lag is. And because, smart TVs, these HD and 4K TVs, they do a lot of processing, some of which you can turn off, for instance, in a game mode, some of which you can't. There's a certain minimum lag that you can get with these TVs that's just depending on the quality of parts that they use and the type of processor that they have, et cetera. And so even if you do everything you can in the settings to try to reduce the lag, there's still a fair amount of variance from the best models down to the worst models. And the performance on input lag doesn't necessarily trend along the path of different brands. So, no. For instance, some Sony TVs have amazing input lag. In fact, they're probably the best for input lag, and some have the worst. LG TVs are known for having really bad input lag, except that they have – or was it Vizio? Maybe it was Vizio is known for having really bad input lag, except they have a new line of Vizio TVs that are very large called the P series, and they are now considered one of the front runners in input lag if you get a TV in that particular line of models. So it's all very confusing. It's very hard to find. Even that website that I mentioned has a very incomplete list of models, and I was trying to use it to cross-reference all the ones that I could actually see for sale in these stores and could see the prices on. And in most cases, the TVs right in front of me were not listed on their website. They're human. They can't test every single TV that comes out. No one can. And that makes this very hard. And then people are like, well, did you look at the reviews on Amazon? It's like, yeah, those are customer reviews. The average customer buying a TV doesn't even have the hardware to test input lag. And if they even know what it is. So it's really, really hard to find good information on this. But I finally made sure, and this is a pro tip for anybody who's going out to buy a TV this year. If you're looking at it in the store and they have a display up, which they probably do, ask them to bring over the remote control for it and let you navigate around the menus. So you should at least make sure that there's a game mode. Because it's one of those things that it probably doesn't say on the box. But if they have the remote and the store clerk can bring it out for you to check on the display model, you can at least go through there and see what you can turn off and what you can turn on and what options you might have to adjust the lag and try to get it down as low as possible. And even then, and I certainly assured that my Samsung has a game mode, although it's in a weird place in the menus that's kind of a pain in the ass to get to, but it does have game mode and it does work. Even then, I was kind of concerned about just how the performance was going to be. Especially by the time I got it home, which took like an hour to get it home and get it out of the car and up to my apartment and get it out of the box. It was just this massive undertaking. By the time I did all that, I thought, man, this TV better be amazing because I really don't want to have to take it back to the store. It's such a pain in the ass. But I hooked it all up and I finally verified that, yes, I think the input lag is at least as good or better than the TV I had before because I was able to set a new high score in Resogun. So I felt really good about that. And I played some Geometry Wars too, and that felt very responsive. It felt like it was doing exactly what I wanted it to. And those are kind of my go-to Twitch arcadey games that you want the best possible reactions from. So anyway, that was kind of my story. I have not even had time to play my Wii U this week at all. So I can't even tell you how those games look on there. I'm pretty excited to see it.
They probably look kick-ass in 4K.
If the Wii U could output to 4K. Now, it will upscale, but game mode is going to turn off the upscaler because that's going to be one of the prime sources of input lag.
Yeah.
So you want upscaling on for things like movies where the input lag is meaningless because you're not actually interacting with it.
Yeah, who gives a shit?
But yeah, for game mode, you really don't want that upscaler on. And I'm going to say it's probably not going to do that much for you anyway. Well, then again, I mean, you look at like the Dolphin emulator screenshots. Maybe upscaling is like the greatest thing ever. I don't know, but I don't think it's really practical on these TVs just because they're processors. They don't have like these blazing fast processors for like decoding all that stuff on the fly.
Right. I mean,
they're not really optimized for that.
And there's a little bit of a law of diminishing returns going on too.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do suspect that a lot of my favorite Wii U games are going to look really fantastic. And actually, I would love to see what Kirby and the Rainbow Curse looks like on there, but I'm going to have to wait until I can get some people over to play it with me, because otherwise I'll never actually see what it looks like on the TV if I'm playing it by myself.
Well, I'm sure you can't wait to get Maze up and running on that TV and see how it looks, but
Maze?
All the fine Wii U software.
The second game by the guy who made the letter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. No, I will never touch that ever in my life.
That's for the best.
I'm sure I will have nothing to do with that game. No, but anyway, yeah. So new TV time. I mean, this is, a very rare event for me. So it's been a big deal, and it's nice to come home every day and look at that thing and go, oh, my God, I can't believe I own that and that it's in my house. Because it's freaking huge. It's not the biggest TV ever, but it's by far the biggest I've ever owned. The other thing I'd like to talk about, is a game that came out on 3DS last week. In fact, I think since the time we did the last episode of the show, it's called Titan Attacks. And, it's an independent game, that's being published by Curve Digital. And, this is an interesting company that's, becoming more prominent. You're probably going to hear a lot more about them, especially in 2015, because they are bringing, I think they might be releasing like half a dozen games on the Wii U and 3DS this year, something like that. They've announced a lot of them. And they're kind of an indie publisher. And the idea is that they take these independent games that, are often made by very small teams, one or two people. They put it out on Steam, for instance, or maybe PS4 or something like that, Vita. And Curve Digital helps them port it to other platforms and get it through certification, everything with these console owners like Nintendo, and then get it up on these digital platforms. So they did that with Titan Attacks. Curve, this is the same company that, as a studio, has made games like Stealth Inc. 2, which was on Guillaume and my top five from last year, and also, of course, the Fluidity games and a few other ones. But this is a game they didn't make themselves. They just helped bring it to 3DS. And Titan Attack, I didn't actually play it on 3DS. I've had it for a few months because it came out on the Vita last year and became a PS Plus game. So I've had it for a while. I've played it before, and I enjoyed it well enough. It didn't, like, blow me away or anything, but I'd played a fair bit of it when it first came out on PS Plus, and so I decided to pick it back up again and play some more of it for the show, because my understanding is that the 3DS version is a pretty straight port, as you might expect. You know, they're kind of doing this on a shoestring, just trying to get these games out on more platforms and get them in more hands. So I don't think the 3DS version is dramatically different, although I do believe that the display might stretch across both screens. So I think it might have that vertical thing going on that, you remember Space Invaders Extreme for the DS?
Right. I'm not sure about that, but I do know that Don in his review says that there are some animations missing, and he found that really off-putting. Like, it's such a simple-looking game, it feels, suffer through too much through the conversion to 3DS, but it does.
Right. Yeah, that's strange to hear, for sure. Because, yeah, it's a very simple-looking game. I mean, it's pixel art. It's not even as flashy as Space Invaders Extreme, which had this, you know, kind of psychedelic art style to it and a lot of flashing and weird motion blur and neon stuff like that. Titan Attacks is a little more straightforward looking. It looks nice, for sure, but it is basically Space Invaders. And about halfway through the game, it sort of evolves gradually into something a little bit more like Galaga. Or one of the Galaga sequels that not as many people have played. But you're just a ship. You can only move left and right along the bottom and shoot upwards. It doesn't have the little armor hut base things, you know, the fortifications that Space Invaders does that the enemies gradually eat through. So it's more like Galaga in that respect. There's nothing between you and the enemies, but the enemies are kind of filling up from the top in these rows, and they're marching slowly downward closer and closer to you, and they're going back and forth. And you just have to zoom around, dodge their shots, and blast all of them. There's also these UFOs that whiz by along the very top of the screen. And if you can manage to get a shot past all the other enemies in between and hit that UFO with just the right timing, it'll drop some money. And that's the most interesting and most important thing about Titan Attacks, because you collect this money, and there's only one or two ways to get it. Sometimes you play a whole level and get no money at all, which is kind of frustrating, but it's kind of a skill reward. So you really have to be paying attention to get that money. And what you do with the money is that at the end of each level, there's a little shop, and you get a chance to buy things. This reminded me of you guys ever play UN Squadron?
Yeah.
Something like that. Where between the levels, you have a chance to buy actually, Lords of Thunder does this as well. But there's a little shop where you can... I was waiting for it.
Yeah.
There's a little shop where you can buy extra shields for your... you know, it's basically to fill back up your health meter. You can boost the power of your guns or make your guns shoot faster. You can add extra lasers and things like that, or buy smart bombs. And those things get progressively more expensive as well, as you buy them and play through the game. I like that kind of system in a game like this. It's basically just an arcade game, but it gives it a sense of persistence from level to level, because you're kind of saving up you can either choose to buy something cheap that will maybe consumable or that won't help you as much, or you can try to save up your money, and take a few more risks along the way, and make enough to buy something really big and dramatic that'll make a big difference. But the tricky thing about Titan Attacks is that the enemies are getting more difficult and smarter and more mobile as you go along. So it ends up being – it feels kind of like an arms race, because you're trying to make sure that your ship is being upgraded fast enough that you can keep up with the advancements that the enemies are getting every time you go to a new stage, and they get harder and harder. So that's an interesting aspect to it. And I like Titan Attacks quite a bit. The only problem I would say is that, you know, it, because of all this persistence and the fact that there are boss levels every 20 stages or so, I think there's a boss. Mm-hmm. It feels a little less arcadey than something like Space Invaders Extreme, which is kind of just like, hey, here's a level. Maybe there's a boss at the end. Maybe there's not. But when it's over, you get your high score, and then you can play another level if you want to. Titan Attacks feels more like – it doesn't have a story, but it feels more like you're on a quest. You know, it feels more like a shoot 'em up, I guess, because you keep advancing, and your ship gets more and more powerful. The enemies get more and more powerful, and It's addictive in that it's you always feel like I could do just one more stage, and I'll have enough to buy that thing, and then I'll quit. So it's very engaging in that way, but you will blow through this game pretty fast. If you have any experience with these kind of vertical shoot 'em up type games, if you've ever played Space Invaders or Extreme or Galaga, Titan Attacks is not particularly difficult overall. Even towards the end, I think it's not that bad. And your ship just gets obscenely powerful by the end. It's shooting all this crazy crap out of it. And it's pretty easy to blast through it pretty fast, and there's just not a ton of content to it. So that's the only warning I would give.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I like the idea of a shop where you can upgrade your ship more than I actually like the how it was implemented. I think that it takes away from the Space Invaders design, just because it makes it a little bit too easy to win or to be overpowered. And yeah, like you blast through the game and then you have to basically start over fully powered, but the enemies don't get really that much more difficult, that much more challenging in the beginning levels. So there's really no reason to go through it another time unless you really enjoy mashing the shoot button and really finishing these levels really, really easily. And it takes away from the whole high score side of it, because it you know, as you said, it's kind of random when you get money or not. So it I don't know, it doesn't make it as pure an arcade experience as something like Space Invaders.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what my high scores are in Titan Attacks, and I kind of don't care.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Emphasize that aspect very much.
So in that, because of that, I'd rather just play Space Invaders Extreme again, or even like the original. I don't know. I'd like to have that downloadable in the 3DS. Or
you know,
if they had only, like, what they could have done would be to have kind of an arcade mode where you don't buy power-ups. And that would have been enough. Like, there's enough small wrinkles in the Space Invaders gameplay to avoid a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Like, you can shoot down, like, sometimes when you shoot down a ship, it's not going to just explode in the sky. It's going to crash. And you can try to hit it again as it crashes down to get more points. Right. And or sometimes, you know, like the little alien will parachute down and you try to capture it to get money. So if they had like just those two wrinkles are pretty cool in and of themselves, and they could have made a good arcade only game with that.
Yeah, I think that would have been good as a bonus mode.
Yeah, for sure. I would have loved that.
That had, you know, the full online leaderboards, and that gave you something a little more narrowly focused to concentrate on if you really want to be competitive with other people. I agree. I think that's a good idea. But yeah, I mean, I still think Titan Attacks is good. I don't know offhand what it costs on the eShop right now. I'm sure it's not that expensive, but
it's $10.
Okay. Yeah. It's definitely in a weird place for those of us who do have multiple platforms available, because, you know, I think, Curve Digital, and this is true of a lot of the games. I mean, they just released Ollie Ollie this week on both the Wii U and the 3DS, and that's cross-buy, which is really amazing that they've pulled that off on the same day that Nintendo is doing it with the new Mario versus Donkey Kong. And I'm curious to see how that plays out for them. But Ollie Ollie is also a game that's been out well over a year on other platforms, including PC and PlayStation, And that also was a PlayStation Plus game at one point. So they're trying to sell these games to a Nintendo audience when these games have not only been around for a long time on other platforms, but at times they've been, you know, arguably free, or whatever quotes you want to put around free when a game comes out for PlayStation Plus. But they've been part of a very popular subscription, all-you-can-play service.
Right, and in Ollie Ollie's case, it's even made worse by the fact that the same week that this comes out, the first game comes out on Nintendo systems, the sequel was released and for free for PlayStation Plus subscribers.
Right, so Ollie Ollie 2 is already out the same week on PlayStation, PS4, and Vita, as a free PS Plus game. So it's weird. I mean, I feel like they, you know, Curve Digital, they must be going after people who just only have Nintendo systems, obviously. Because if you had a Sony system, you would probably already have these games. Now, they're good games. You know, they're easy to recommend. It just feels a little bit weird, but maybe I'm just the freak who actually has both platforms. And so for me, I mean, I would never buy it on the Nintendo system. I don't care enough to own it on two different handhelds in my house. I can only play one at a time. But I am glad these games are coming out for Nintendo fans, because they're good games and they're interesting. And you know, it's nice that we have more indie game distribution on the eShop. That's good for everybody. But it creates kind of a weird conundrum. And for those of us who do already have the Sony platforms, it's kind of an odd prospect to see people talking about these games, because they've been out for a long time and a lot of us have already played them and didn't even pay for them directly. But, hey, more power to them. I hope it works out for them. It's a strange prospect. But yeah, I mean, certainly playing Titan Attacks made me think about Space Invaders Extreme a lot, because I absolutely love that game on the DS and played it till my fingers, like my wrists hurt and my thumbs were raw. And, because I never got the little knob Arkanoid controller for it that you can plug in the GBA slot.
That thing was fantastic.
Man.
Talked about it. It was,
yeah, it's great.
It was only Japan only. So you had to import it if you wanted one, and they were a little pricey, and it only works with like three games ever. So
yeah. It's like the most useless thing ever outside of that game.
Yeah. But there was a Space Invaders Extreme 2 that I never played.
That was the PSP camera, John.
Sorry, my bad. And there's always something. There's always something that trumps Sony.
Yeah, but I always wanted to play Space Invaders Extreme 2, and I never got to. So if they ever do a DS Virtual Console service for 3DS, I'm all about Space Invaders Extreme 2. I would love for that to come out. I talked longer than I meant to, so let's move on to John Lindemann for a few minutes.
All right. Something else. Yeah, I managed to play through the demo of the campaign of Ironfall Invasion.
During this podcast. You might have heard him during part of Johnny's new business. You might have heard it.
Probably. yeah. That's the thing. I didn't realize it was out. So I was kind of, I've been busy this week and I didn't realize it had actually been released. I haven't had much time to play anything outside of the Pokemon trading card game. But, yeah, and this was something that I had been curious about. Looked a lot like Gears of War. This is, of course, I guess you could say a cover-based shooter. I don't think that's the name for the genre now. But yeah, this is a straight out Gears of War clone.
Ripoff.
Let's say, I'll be kind and say it's a clone. It looks really good. So you download it for free and then you can purchase the rest of the campaign and then you can purchase the multiplayer as well. I'm not sure if you can do those separately, but yeah, so it's kind of, they kind of have that model going for it. So it looks really, really good. And it looks exactly, I mean, picture Gears of War, how you think Gears of War would look on the 3DS, and this is it. I mean, your guy looks like one of the Gears of War guys. He has that kind of chunky art style. And you know, it's, you know, everything is, you know, the, everything is cover based. So, in the first area, you're walking through rooms in this, you know, in this kind of like, office area building, sort of kind of like a compound that you're infiltrating. And, you know, there's some terrible story. And so you're fighting these robot enemies that all look virtually the same. Much like Gears of War, again, just waves of enemies being tossed at you. You have to hide behind stuff. You know, pop out, take them out, that kind of stuff. And, but it actually plays pretty well. And you can do everything. I mean, you can hide behind stuff and then, you know, hop over it. I mean, everything. I mean, just Gears of War right down to pretty much everything, even to the point where Gears of War, they introduced the mechanic where, when you reload your gun, they have that bar where if you hit it in the sweet spot, you reload quicker. They even have that. I mean, it is a Gears of War clone, absolutely right down to the smallest detail.
They have active reloading?
Yeah.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean,
that's,
it's
kind of shameless.
It is. It's absolutely shameless. And, and the cutscenes are pretty good. They're fully voiced. Story is pretty terrible. They're pretty terribly acted. But I mean, it's good. I mean, it's, you know, there's really not a whole lot to say about it because it is so straightforward. It's like, it is exactly Gears of War.
But, yeah, but just the fact that this game is on a Nintendo system at all is kind of a big deal because we never got Uncharted. We never got anything like Gears of War. I can't really think of anything on the, I don't know, on the Wii. Like, there weren't that many shooters. Usually there were rail shooters, or on the Wii U we did get Call of Duty, but that's first person. First person. Yeah, like, we just don't get these games.
Yep. I was actually impressed. I'm going to check out the online multiplayer. Maybe I'll talk about it next week, but apparently it's, I mean, you can do, you can have quick matches. I'd be curious to see actually how they set it up. It may have voice chat. I think I saw something about that in the menus, but I'm not 100% sure. Don't quote me on that.
It does. It's called Skype.
That's like every Nintendo game. Let me actually just quickly have
you're
a look
here. You're going to give us some more background music? Is that what you're going to do?
You want to hear the background music, Smart Guy?
I've been hearing it all on podcasts.
There you go,
so, yeah.
Buddy. There you go.
All right.
Yep.
Now we're going to get content ID'd on our own podcast channel. We'll be good to go.
Yeah, but
I don't think YouTube can reach us here.
It'll be flagged as Gears of War.
But yeah, it interests me that they didn't choose to just sell it. I mean, it's smart, the fact that they chose to sell it kind of as, you know, almost episodic in a way, like you can just sort of, that surprised me, because these games like this kind of typically they're just like tossed out, you know, like I kind of compared this when I first talked about this a couple of weeks ago that, you know, expressed my interest in it. It reminds me of games by Sheenan, who puts out beautiful shooters, but they kind of like lack something, you know? It's like they're more concerned with, you know, putting on a technical display with the hardware than they are about kind of wrapping it in a compelling story or anything like that. And it kind of
can't do it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go, some caught my
go
throat.
Figure. So yeah. So in that vein, I would probably give this an 8.5 out of 10. Yeah. So. But it's interesting, you know, like that. I don't know if I would actually pay for the rest of this game, but I mean, it's 20. I'm looking at it. The multiplayer and campaign bundle, it's $20. I don't know. See, I mean, the thing is, the story isn't compelling enough for me to say, boy, this sounds really interesting. I want to actually see how the rest of the story plays out.
Have you ever really said that about a Gears of War game? Man, this story.
No, but the thing is with Gears of War, though, is I will say that, those games tend to up the ante. They look really good, and they tend to up the ante as you go along. Like, the bosses get crazier and stuff like that. So there is kind of that hook. I mean, the stories are pretty terrible. The characters are, you know, they're cardboard. But generally those games are such a graphical showcase on such a scale that you just want to see where else they go with it and what other crazy stuff they do. I mean, some of those games, like, you know, they have you fight, like I said, like a massive boss, or they have you fighting on a train, or just doing crazy stuff like that. So there is kind of that carrot pulling you forward. But with this, I mean, I feel like, yeah, this, I've seen what it can do graphically, but I don't know really what else they could do beyond that. Like, I don't think the story is going to improve. I don't think anything like that is going to really improve. So.
Well, so making it this free demo and then you can buy the rest of it makes sense, because the odds are that if this game had come out and you had to pay right away, it was going to get like 5 downloads.
Yeah.
And the sales pitch is nearly impossible.
Yep.
So even if their sell-through rate is only like 1% of the people who download it, they're still going to get it in more hands than they would otherwise, because people will have a chance to play something of it. They will be aware of this game simply because it is a free experience on their 3DS.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out last week, so it's and something that's not Donkey Kong.
Yeah. Yep.
So I get it. I understand that there's a certain logic to this that makes it work even better on the 3DS, simply because 3DS eShop is kind of a dumping ground for games and things don't tend to do very well there. It's a bad place.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is also one of the first games that's, you know, sort of enhanced for new 3DS and has been promoted alongside new 3DS to some extent. John, I'm curious, did you try this with your Circle Pad Pro?
Yeah, I did. It's the only way to game, buddy. The only way to game. Yeah, and I mean, it plays pretty well. I mean, the kind of critiques I would say about the controls, I think probably to maintain the frame rate's really smooth, and I think to kind of to achieve that, you turn around really slowly. So, you know, in Gears of War, like, yeah. you really pop around really, really quick. That's one of the things that makes that game feel so good is, you know, you can scan over an area really, really quickly. In this one, you turn pretty slowly. They do have a control that you can, tap backwards twice and do a 180, which it's pretty obvious. I'm sure when they play tested this, they said, hey.
Yeah, you know, that was a play testing edition.
Yep. So you can do that, but it plays pretty slowly. It's smooth, but kind of slow. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for checking that out, man. Maybe you'll stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely going to check out the multiplayer for sure. I don't think it has voice chat. Not that surprising. Not that that's surprising anybody. Yeah, it does have Street Pass though. So hey, I don't know how they do that. I don't know what they do with that.
Wonderful.
Well, yeah. For a free game to have Street Pass is kind of cool because maybe a lot of people will have it.
Maybe. So you can play an online match and also a local match as well. So it has both of those. And it has a...
Maybe it brings other people's me into your game and you can bring a shotgun to their faces.
Whoa! We've taken that out of our Nintendo games. Thank you.
Yeah. It also seems to have like a swarm mode where like you just fight hordes of enemies.
Hmm.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it's
a synonym for horde.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. So it's Gears of War for sure.
Cool. All right, man. Well, I think we have had enough new business for 1 week, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Pokemon the Trading Card Game in the year 2015.
Pika, stick around.
Yep.
Pika, Pika!
No, absolutely not. Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review, Titan Attacks on 3DS by Don Koopman. Good old Kusage Koopman, Koopsoge, returns, but this time he's swerving us by not playing a complete dumpster fire. Curve's Space Invaders homage is much better than his usual fare, but find out if it improves on the formula of the original game or is just taking up space. I didn't screw that script up, John.
Well, mostly. Editing will be kind.
Yeah, editing will fix this. You listening at home won't have any idea what I fucked up, but I fucked up one line in there. We also have a preview, Xenoblade Chronicles 3D on the new 3DS, also by Don Koopman. We're just going to call this now Koopmaning. We all know Xenoblade Chronicles is great, but how is it transferred to the new 3DS? Don reveals all and tells us whether or not this game is only for a bunch of jokers, or if it's Koopman time.
Yeah, he reveals all. I mean, he strips nude.
It's
crazy.
It's.
I mean,
more
power to him.
For this, I wasn't prepared mentally or physically,
yeah,
or emotionally.
I mean, it's Koopman time, all right.
But it's Koopman time.
Whew. All right. Okay. So we have a review also of Mario vs. Donkey Kong, Tipping Stars for 3DS, again by Don Koopman. Amazing. Right here on Koopman World Report, Don lets us know if the newest entry in this series is worth your time. In fact, you could almost say that he's tipping you off as to whether you should start planning to play this game. Oh man, it's too easy. The puns are just too easy.
I feel like I should start planning to not record this segment anymore.
All right, and we have an editorial this week. The different controls of Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. Neil and Alex take a look at the best way to control Capcom's Beast Fest.
That game doesn't sound like what we're...
Is it the original 3DS? The 3DS XL? The Circle Pad Pro? The new 3DS Nub? So many handhelds, so few dual analog sticks. Find out which one they prefer, and happy hunting.
All this and more Beast Fests, hairy, muscular Beast Fests, are available to you right now in a very sweaty form on NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back, everybody. It is time for Retroactive. This is the 31st time, not including the minis that we did for 400. It is the 31st Retroactive feature. We've been doing it for many years now. And if you're new to the show, I'll explain just briefly. The idea is that we try to get the community involved with these as much as possible, usually with the selection of the game as well as in the feature itself that we're about to do. And we choose a set of nominated games. Usually they're suggested by listeners. And then we have a poll in most cases. And the winning game out of that poll, we play it, and everybody else who's able to plays along with us. And then we have a segment here on the show, and we talk about it amongst ourselves. And we also bring in comments from everybody who's been playing along, who's been dropping them in the official forum thread. So that's what we're going to do. The idea is we all play a game together as much as is reasonable in this particular format, and hopefully discover something that we'd never played before or that we played a long time ago and can come to with fresh eyes. In this case, other than James, I believe this was basically the first time any of us had played Pokemon the Trading Card Game, which was released for Game Boy Color back in the year 2000. Does that sound right? I don't have Wikipedia or Nintendo World Report open to check my facts here.
I don't think it was 2000.
99 or 2000 would have been, because the original Red and Blue came out in 98, so it would have been after that, but before GBA. So yeah, 99 or 2000, regardless. This, of course, is the handheld digital version of the actual Pokemon trading card game that was played on paper cards by millions of children and teenagers and adults around the world, and is still played today, as far as I know.
Yep.
And I'm curious how many of us had really played around with the actual paper cards before this?
None. I think I got some trading cards as some E3 swag at some point.
Yeah, I've got one or two sitting in a box somewhere, probably.
I was around when that weird thing happened and they became basically gold.
Mm.
And people just couldn't get them, but I never actually played them, no.
Right, and I never got into Pokemon in the first place back when it blew up, so I never got into the card game, of course.
Okay. Well, at the time in the late 90s or very early 2000s when the card game was really in its prime and was extremely popular, extremely lucrative, I was very interested in the games themselves. I was playing Pokemon Blue and then later Pokemon Diamond actually was my next one. But I didn't have too much interest in the trading card game. I knew that it had been designed by Richard Garfield, who is the guy who designed the original Magic the Gathering sets. And he, same guy, the same company, produced the cards and distributed them, the Wizards of the Coast, around the world. And I knew that it was not a variant of Magic the Gathering, but had a lot of similarities. It was, you know, kind of a similar setup. Most people said a little bit simpler, still had some strategy to it. But, being by the late 90s, I, had played a hell of a lot of Magic the Gathering, especially in the mid 90s. By that time, I wasn't playing it actively anymore. I would end up picking it up, again in college with some other friends who had also kind of grown up on it a few years earlier. But at the time, playing a simplified version of Magic the Gathering was not appealing to me, even though that's probably not a fair, description of Pokemon the Trading Card Game. So I didn't know the rules before this. There's a long story short. I think that's true of all of us except James, who played this game a couple months ago when it first came out on.
Of course, I didn't know the rules then either. So
right. So we're all new to it. I'm curious how we all feel about how the game teaches you the rules and the kind of basic strategies.
It teaches you the rules and basic strategies?
Yeah, I think it tells you what the rules are, but not exactly the strategies.
Exactly. Yeah. I would echo that. It doesn't really tell you how to play. It tells you what to do.
Yeah.
Right.
And
it literally says, now play this card. And it's like, okay, now you know how to play the game. It's like, well, not particularly, no.
Well, you know the basics. You know that before you can do an attack, you have to put your, well, first you have to put your Pokemon down on the table. Then you put backup Pokemons and you attach energy to them. And then you can attack. So that's good things to know.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a super scaled down version of the basics. I mean, there's stuff like, oh, you want to put down two energy on the first turn? Fuck you, you can't.
Yeah.
You can only do one per turn.
Yeah, it does. Right. Well, the thing is, I think the game, though, when you play it, it does a fairly good job of telling you explicitly what you can't do and why. You know?
It doesn't punish you for making these mistakes. I mean, if you try to do something you're not allowed to, it doesn't make you forfeit the rest of your turn or something like that because you broke the rules. It just says, oh, you can't do that. Do something else.
Right. Or if you're about to do something you might regret, usually you have the option to back out. Like if you have an attack mm-hmm. that demands that you give up one of your energy cards attached to the Pokemon, it's going to ask you, well, choose one. So you have time to, you can press B, you can back up. And be like, whoa, that's not what I meant to do.
Yeah. And to be fair, the game does not punish you for losing matches.
No.
So you are able to go out. In fact, we have a good forum quote. We can throw that out there. Well, a couple on this. So Yoshi1001, who is very active in the forum thread, said, one nice thing about this game is the fact that the CPUs, or the computer-controlled characters, aren't playing super optimal decks. So you have the freedom to explore the cards more than you would have at a tournament back in the day. If they were real people, I'd feel bad about beating them so badly, though. but there was another quote that talked about this, and that was from Supercurb posted, "This game so far has been a great way for me to learn how the Pokemon card game works, or at least how I think it works. I remember collecting these cards as a kid, but I never really understood what things like energy cards and trainer cards did. I would either toss those cards out or just store them in the back of my Pokebinder. Anyway, this game is taking me back to a period in my life where I really adored everything Pokemon. I think it's pretty amazing how an old game I've never played before is making me feel this way."
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a cool usage of the Pokemon concept. Like, I mean, the Pokemon concept really does translate very well to a card game. More so than I would have actually thought.
I would agree with that, actually. I was kind of surprised at how much it felt like I was – like it, to me, it felt like a more complicated, more strategic, more satisfying version of the battles that you do in the Pokemon RPG games.
Yep. I would agree.
It feels similar in that you're still concerned about matching up the types of the Pokemon. So, you know, I definitely want to use water against a fire opponent. And then if he switches out with something else, then I might want to switch out mine to try to keep up with what he's doing, or else we'll end up with a mismatch that's disadvantage to me. Mm-hmm. So I think it captures that well. It's one Pokemon at a time. It's always one-on-one duels. And if you don't have a Pokemon on your side, then you lose.
Yeah,
so you have to have a Pokemon out all the time. That's how you stay alive.
Yeah. I mean, there's multiple kind of tactics and things you have to watch out for. Like you said, like it's not a race to destroy the other team's Pokemon. It's a race to get the most prizes, right? Mm-hmm. So that's something like that's kind of a wrinkle you can play different ways.
Well,
and also you can't always switch out your Pokemon either, which adds a little wrinkle to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of strategy in using Pokemon that are either really powerful that you may be kind of stuck with for a while until they die.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so expensive to retreat and switch out with another one. Or you can draw cards that let you do it for free. If you get the switch card, for instance, or mm-hmm. a scoop up, you can use that to pull your Pokemon out and put another one in. Or you can play cards that may not be as aggressively powerful, but they're very sort of agile, you know, like, and I think they do a good job of making that fit with the concept of the creature, like the small, nimble, fast creatures that look like they would be very fast typically are the ones that are the easiest to retreat and pull out for little or no cost and then put something else in. So you can play a lot of tricks strategically with swapping in and out monsters and trying to keep the opponent off balance.
Mm-hmm. The whole like attaching energy to the cards before you can use attacks, that's very similar to Magic the Gathering, right? Like I had the
Not
one
really.
Time.
No, because no? you don't attach them directly. They're just
No, but you'd need them out and then you need to activate them or something before you can do anything, right?
Well, like, in Magic, they're a resource. It's more like an allowance. So it's more like, you get your allowance at the beginning of every turn. You untap all your mana, and then you can spend it any way you want to throughout your turn. You can do a lot of different things. You can play cards from your hand, or you can use abilities of the creatures that you already have out, and all these different possibilities. You can hold some in case on the opponent's turn there may be certain things you can do to respond to that, which this game has none of. I mean, if it's not your turn, there's nothing you can do ever. You're just watching the game play whenever it's the opponent's turn, which I found disappointing. It's very uninvolving in that way. Mm-hmm. But in Magic, the idea is that your mana is kind of highly reconfigurable. You can use it in a lot of different ways every turn. And then when it comes back to your turn again, all that you spent gets regenerated. And now you have a chance to use it in different ways on your next turn. Yeah, so it's much more complicated, but it's also much more flexible. Yeah, and in Pokemon, you attach those energy cards to the Pokemon, and then it's probably going to stay there until the monster dies and the energy goes away.
Right.
So you're committing a lot more when you put one down.
Right. Well, I guess that makes it a little bit more like Pokemon battles, because you don't put all the Pokemon out at the same time. They don't battle it out in, you know, a melee. It's like one-on-one, and then you take one back and you send another when the first one died. Or
two-on-two battles. But
sure.
Well, they've added that later on. I mean, they've even gone up to three-on-three battles and things like that in some of the later games. And that's actually more like Magic the Gathering, where you're actually assigning blockers and you get into these and that's where a lot of the rules get really confusing and complicated and hard to learn for newcomers. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot more strategic possibilities there as well.
It's part of
what makes Pokemon fairly straightforward. It's like you really only, you kind of want to know what the other guy has as a backup, so that when you kill a monster or if he switches it out, you kind of want to know what might come in order to prepare. But most of the time, you really only care about what's the monster sitting out there right now.
Well, and I mean, this is going to be a little bit complicated for us to sort of talk about the game and talk about the game is representing. Dividing the line there when we're discussing how this game handles stuff and how the source material handles stuff. So in the sense that, you know, like energy's gone when the monster dies, with the exception of using some kind of specialty card to sort of preserve it. That was always a real bummer, especially if you work on the strategy of you're going up against a trainer that you have a fully evolved form that is going to wreck everything they have.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the types. You have a fully evolved starter with a type advantage, essentially, in a badge. So you've had to dump probably 5 cards of energy on that thing, and three of them are probably locked to being that specific type.
Yeah, I mean, for the better ones, at least 4. Usually,
it's a very tough loss to take.
And it takes a long time to build up to that point, because you're only allowed to play 1 energy per turn.
Right.
Right.
So that's part of the reason that I basically didn't use evolutions. And I had a lot of success. I so far have 6 out of the 8 medals, and I've used basically the same deck for all but 1 medal.
That's the thing. It forces you to throw out, you know, the high hit point cards, because what you do is you throw that guy out there as a tank, and he just gets hit a bunch of times while you're sitting there just hopefully gaining the cards that you want to pump up 1 Pokemon that you actually really want to use.
It's in a Pokemon game, a regular one. I'm not an expert, but I assume that you're kind of meant to have a rounded team. In this game, it's just going to kill you. You can't do that because you need so many different types of energy cards. Really, I could not win against the very first battle, like not the training one, but one of the other assistants.
That's normal.
Assistants in the lab. I used the default deck I had picked up, but it had 3 different types of Pokemon in it, I did not win until I took one out. Basically, I just converted them all to water instead of fire,
It's funny to hear you say that, because it's such a common problem in Magic the Gathering among new players that they try to put 4 or all 5 colors of cards in their first deck. Mm-hmm. And the deck is so difficult to make anything function, because it's so complicated and there's so many preconditions for doing any of the cool stuff that you look at the cards and think, oh man, this is such a cool card, I can't wait to use this. But your deck isn't really set up to enable that at all. And in deck building, this is by far my favorite thing about these kinds of games, is the deck building. I love sort of fortifying it and
yeah.
like optimizing it,
yeah,
pulling
you
out all the
fat.
You
have to set
the,
your deck up
fat.
To work towards something.
Yeah, like you learn how to make it lean and efficient and fast, and you learn how to get to the cards that you really need, and anything that's not going to help you win, you take out. Mm-hmm. It, you know, so you get to where the decks do become sort of singularly minded a lot of times because you have a pretty specific idea of what you want to happen when you play this deck, and everything in there should be helping you get towards that goal, basically, mm-hmm. rather than just kind of, you know, smear of just, oh, here's all my favorite cards all in one deck. That's never the right way to do it.
Nope.
You know,
nope.
You have to have a more strategic approach to it. And of course, you know, kids, a lot of times your first instinct is, I want to put Pikachu in there because he's my favorite character, but he's not a good card. You should not put him in your deck in most cases.
Nope.
But he's on the game cover.
Sorry, Pikachu. No
love.
Well,
and the difference there between the card game and normal Pokemon is that in normal Pokemon, you can take a character that's probably not that strong, but if you train it long enough, eventually it'll become viable in almost any setting just because you put so much time into it. You can teach it all these different moves along the way. And you can, you know, gear its stats development in one direction or another and eventually make it viable. So you can always have like a good version of whatever your favorite character is in the card game. That's just not going to happen. The cards are what they are. You can't level up the cards. You can evolve them with other cards, but there's no experience points in the card game.
Yeah. I mean, you can also, you know, drop very advanced monsters in right off the bat too. You don't have to build them up to, you don't have to evolve them.
Right.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like for that reason, the normal types that have no type on them whatsoever are to an extent overpowered.
They are powerful for sure. Yeah.
So like, the Kangaskhan cards I had like three of them because they're just so, you have to put a ton of energy on them, but you can put whatever the fuck you want on there.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah. I played against one of those and I was like, this guy sucks. Yeah. No. He was
no,
really hard
yeah,
to play against.
Because he hits like a brick.
Well, he hits like a brick because he's the one that he has his lowest attack is the draw card.
Yeah.
And
which
I was
that's
like,
actually, that's a much better move than you think.
Yes, oh, yeah. I know. I'm just like, I'm sitting there because I'm exhausting my cards and they all suck. And this guy's just like, draw.
Oh,
and he's just sitting there, right? And of course, I can't. This guy, he has like 80 hit points or something. So I'm just hitting him and really not doing a hell of a lot.
If I had it at the start of the game, it went out first.
Oh, God, and, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And I just drew. And even if I had enough to make him useful, I may just keep drawing.
Yep.
Until it goes down.
Such a massive advantage.
I'm going to give up the first prize because it's just baiting, you know, to be fully evolved whatever the fuck else I've got sitting in here.
Yeah.
It's the thing about this game that frustrates me is that I respect that the idea is, well, you got to figure it out on your own. But at the same time, they probably should discuss, you know, they know what your first deck is. They gave it to you.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like they could go into, they're doing the training battle. They could go into some cards that have like a specific skill that's maybe not immediately apparent. So like, I'm just going to power this thing up and hit you with it. And just sort of like, just to make you think about that kind of stuff. Just, even if it's not, you know, exhaustive discussion of all the advantages here, putting one of those in front of you and saying, hey, here's a way you could use this that's a little bit different from what your immediate response would be with no experience.
Yeah.
I think that would really help people who are new to this.
Yeah, or like why one card is good versus why one card may not necessarily be bad, but maybe not as effective for you.
Right. Well, there is an area in the game where you can go, like, there's a Pokemon card collector who's written books, like, you can read on the shelves different tips, but it's almost useless, you know? Like, there's one entry where it's, you can think about creating combos with your card. For instance, if you use this and that, then, you know, you can use it this way. Okay, cool, I have neither of those cards. and
yeah,
you're not really helping me, like, because you just mentioned them and you don't really tell me what they do. Like, I don't even understand what you're talking about.
Well,
why do they work well together? So that's not helping me come up with new combos.
And that's why I think it would work really well at the start of the game, because they know exactly what cards you have. And
right.
They could have put a couple cards in there deliberately designed to give you the... Like, a Kangaskhan would be a great example. I think you have one in the starting deck. And they could just say, hey, as opposed to just going out there and trying to start slugging with this thing, really what you want is a big hand. So why don't you just draw cards for a couple turns. And then they could set up the deck and immediately reward you, so now you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I have to say, it's pretty unbalanced in this game that there's no limit to the hand size.
Oh, yeah.
My deck is – and there's a lot of very powerful cards that let you draw lots of extra cards very, very easily. And it's not unusual for me to end a match with 15 cards in my hand. Mm-hmm. And that's 15 options.
Yeah.
For whatever the other guy tries to do, I've probably got an answer to it on the next turn. Mm-hmm. And so in Magic, you know, in most trading, I mean, most card games, period, there, you know, if there's a way to draw extra cards, there's also a counterbalance to that, which is that if you get over a certain amount, you're going to have to discard extras. And so you're going to have to get to a point where you have to choose. You can't just hang on to every single resource.
It goes back to the other thing we talked about, though, where if you're trying to build up evolutions, you're going to have to cash energy because you can't dump it all at one time, and you can't evolve them more than once per turn. So, you know, to limit the number of cards you can hold, they'd have to solve that problem as well, because otherwise you may be trying to gear up to have to play these one turn after another, and you have to throw them out because you can't hold them.
Yeah, but that's what makes the game more interesting. Like, you have to take risks, or you have to build your deck differently.
But it's not really a risk. It's essentially, it's just a sacrifice. Because a risk would imply that there's some potential for reward there. But if the game is giving you a card every turn, it's like, well.
Yeah, but already there is a possibility that the evolution card that you have in your hand is never gonna, like, you're never gonna encounter the base Pokemon, because it might be one of the rewards.
Yes, it could be a prize. Exactly.
So that's already a possibility. You could already be screwed. So
part of why evolution is so risky. Actually, there's a good forum comment about this. So Evan B. posted, "I found the progression of this game to be a bit backwards. Why make me wait until I defeat 4 club leaders to challenge the psychic or science leader? It feels like it's railroading for no other reason aside from typical Pokemon progression. Anyway, I enjoyed the game. However, as an MTG fan, Magic Gathering, I found the mechanics to be unbearably slow, and I have no idea who thought they were a good idea. Energy attachment is just a terrible concept, and it turns the game into a much more stall and trick-based game. The game practically discourages evolution, which is absurd considering the nature of the brand."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean,
I don't completely agree with all those points, a valid opinion.
I knew that, like, okay, so I had something that would need, fighting cards, and I would get, like, you know, like Hitmonchan or something like that, and I would just be like, you know, shit, man, I who knows when I'm going to get the 3 fighting cards I need. Yeah, it's like, it would be useless, because it's like, when am I going to get the 3 fighting cards? I have absolutely no idea. So it's like, to evolve that guy into something better, or say Machop and Machoke or something like that, sometimes you would get that card and you just be like, fuck, man, I'm never going to be able to, like, actually evolve this guy. Because, you know, or use him once I evolve him. You know, it's going to be so far down the line. So that where the stalling comes in, because you're like, shit, I have to hold off until I actually maybe get the fighting cards I need to evolve this guy from Machop to Machoke.
And to that extent, a lot of my deck became devoted to stalling.
Mm-hmm.
So the Nidorans are fucking stall masterpieces because they have Leech Seed. Mm-hmm. So you take 30 damage.
Jigglypuff too. Fucking Jigglypuff.
You restore 20. You take 30 damage, you restore 20. You take 30 you can leech like 4 turns out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't include the turns the other player has to take to get ready to start attacking. So you can just, for one turn, to put that one green energy on the Nidoran, you can buy like 5 turns.
Yeah.
And guess what my next card comes out if I'm not ready? Oh, here's another one. Have fun with that.
There's other things like that too, like, you know, where your character will get put to sleep and then
oh, yeah.
And then, you know, you're sitting there. That's also what I didn't understand either, is kind of like how you can get put to sleep and then immediately come back out of sleep. All that does is just waste your turn. Yes, it wastes your turn, and I can understand that. But sometimes, like my, you know, my guy would get put to sleep like 5 times in a row.
Yep. Yeah. Because that was the only move the opponent had.
Yeah.
Put you to sleep.
And they would, and of course they would never change the creature that they had out there, so it was just like, okay, I'm just going to sit here and just be put to sleep and wake up, put to sleep, wake up, and just keep going and going, and just, yeah.
I mean, I won one of the badges. First off, the element, we're going back to the card game versus this game. The elemental weaknesses being what they are, it kind of takes away from the Pokemon franchise in that, hey, a lot of these things you think are weaknesses, they're not. Because in the card game, you're not going to be weak to four different types because they've simplified a lot of stuff down anyway.
Mm-hmm. There's not as many types. So,
right.
For instance, I noticed there's no rock type. They're all just fighting.
They're fighting. Or there's no poison. They've rolled the poisons into grass. There's no bug. They've rolled them into grass. So right. What you end up with, there's no flying. Yeah. So what you end up with now is like one of the first elemental weaknesses the Pokemon franchise teaches you is that grass kicks the shit out of water. Like that's one of the first thing it teaches you. Well, and actually in this game, it doesn't fucking matter. It's electric or bust.
Yeah, so, that really confused me for a while. I feel like that's fine. I mean, I kind of understand why in a card game, especially because of the way the rules are set up, they might not want 15 different types or now, what is it, 17 or 18 that they're up to
whatever.
Now? That is probably too many, but, the game, I feel like the trading card game or the video game doesn't really explain the types and it doesn't really compare them to normal Pokemon. That's right. One of the weird things about this is that, you're again in this world where every single person is obsessed with Pokemon trading cards
but
and never
no
talk about anything else.
That's
right.
So
but there's no real Pokemon. So there's no one in the game to explain to you the differences between Pokemon the RPG and Pokemon the TCG.
Right.
And I feel like, maybe at the time they were hoping that maybe kids who saw the card games at the playground at school would want to get the Game Boy game. And then from there, maybe they would become interested enough to buy Pokemon Red or Pokemon Blue or vice versa. Maybe people who played Red and Blue and really liked it weren't sure about the expense or the complications of playing the trading card game because then you had to go find people to play it with and they'd be more attracted to this virtual version of the trading card game. But I feel like a tutorial that just kind of explains some of the high level differences between Pokemon and Pokemon cards, that would have helped me a lot because I played plenty of Pokemon. I've never played Pokemon cards. And there's a lot of things that, like, why do the cards have levels if you can't level them up?
Right.
Basically it just means there's variants of different monsters. There's one Pikachu that has these moves and there's another Pikachu that's a different level that has these other moves. You can mix and match them if you want to. They're both called Pikachu, but there's different versions of Pikachu. But the levels, they don't, a level 18 doesn't mean jack shit, even though it says that on the card.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the other point, to the point of using this as a gateway. So this came out in Japan in 98, so 2 years before it came out here.
Mm-hmm.
That's a country where they had already sold 100 trillion copies of Pokemon Green and Blue. So I would presume this was their gateway drug for the high profit margin Pokemon cards. But to that end, it does a terrible job teaching you the difference. Like, to the point where I still don't understand all the elemental weaknesses because it's just like, well, I'll figure it out and I'll see what happens. Like, it's not even really on the cards. Like, it should just say on the card, like, is weak to, and then just list them.
It does actually say that. You can check the card.
Yeah, it does.
It's buried,
Where?
Though. It's buried.
There's an icon.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just says weak, and then you see, like, a little fist, so it's weak to fighting types.
Even those icons can be pretty confusing. You're like, what is that? Like, psychic is what? And they get into like colorless stuff, and some of them like there's kind of like wild card icons too, right?
That is colorless.
Colorless. Yeah.
So I've got something embarrassing to say. It took me a while. I don't know why. It took me way longer than it should have to realize that colorless Pokemon just require any type of card.
It's not explained very well in the game.
It doesn't explain it at all.
I think the only reason the only way it's explained is during that intro battle. At one point, you put another energy type on the one when he's telling you, now put this one on. I think that's it. I think that's the only way it's explained.
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting there
that's
waiting.
Not enough.
I was always sitting there waiting to get this, like, to get like a star card or something like that, and I never got it. And then I'm like, wait a minute, what if I just put down just a random card? I'm like, holy shit, there you go.
Yeah.
So I needed two fighting and then one of anything else. And I was like, okay.
Like, part of the reason why I stayed way too long in the beginning lab was because I was waiting to get a colorless energy card. Like, so, stupidly. Yeah,
so was I, really. I mean, well, I was trying to beat Aaron because, I mean, basically, it became a blood feud.
You're on a first-name basis with this dude?
I hate that guy. I fucking hate Aaron, man. Seriously, I was like, dude, I was going to sit there and grind Aaron until I finally beat his ass.
Oh, man.
But that's the thing. Like, he's really hard when you just play with the deck that you were given.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't know what's wrong.
I had two badges before I beat him. Let's put it that way. Like, that was what it came down to.
But that's another thing, though. The game doesn't tell you where to go.
No,
it's completely non-linear and, almost completely.
It's like 50-50. It's like the first half of the game, then the second half of the
game. So I figured, you know, you should probably, you know, it makes sense to stay in the lab and beat all the early people so, you know, you're more equipped to fight other.
Nope.
But no, mm-hmm. There's actually people, I mean, you can go out onto the map and find people that are way easier to beat that you can just steamroll.
Yeah. Yeah,
and there's also the aspect that I think, especially early in the game, because you're not comfortable with the rules yet, and you also mm-hmm. don't understand a lot of the cards that are in the starter deck that they give you, because they just give you a pre-made deck without really telling you how to use it.
I mean, it's not even
it.
A deck. They just give you garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah, they give you starter. You choose Bulbasaur and Friends or whatever.
Yeah,
right.
But they
contain too many types of Pokemon. Yeah.
Yes.
Bulbasaur's got too many fucking friends is the problem.
Yeah, they're not good decks, and in fact, I don't even think Bulbasaur is a good. I mean, it didn't take me long before my Bulbasaur and Friends deck didn't have Bulbasaur in it anymore. But they, you know, in those early matches, it is easy to get outclassed. It's easy to get frustrated early on. I mean, it happened to me. But it's not clear to the player whether you're playing the game wrong or maybe the deck just fucking sucks and you should change it.
Well, one thing I ran into is they also don't tell you really clearly how to actually edit your deck and like create a new deck, because Johnny, God bless him, was my Pokemon trading card game Sherpa. Because we sat there, yes, there were two grown-ass men going back and forth texting about Pokemon, the trading card game.
Jesus
and Johnny's
Christ.
Like, oh, no, because when I went in there to edit my deck, I saw that you could make a new one. But it's not really clear when you go into the actually deck builder. I couldn't figure out how to add cards. I'm like, okay, so I have zero of one, and like, I'm like, what? What the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, oh, just press left or right. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, you're just changing the number of
right.
The whole deck editor is not intuitive at all.
Can we also briefly mention that you can't have cards in multiple decks?
Yeah, that really chaps my ass. I mean, it makes it more realistic to the physical card game, but it also completely dodges one of the great advantages of playing a virtual collectible card game, which is that, you know, yes, you're collecting the cards and you're adding them to your collection and to your library as you play and you get these booster packs, but also, you know, these decks are basically just like arbitrary configurations that you can change anytime you want to.
Right.
There's no good reason that your virtual card can't exist in multiple decks at the same time. And the fact that this game doesn't let you do that makes it really, it kind of disincentivizes you to carry multiple decks around with you at all times, because then you're having to split up your cards between those two. And in reality, yes, you can go in and modify it and move cards back and forth, but it's so tedious with this interface that you're not going to want to do it.
Hey, here's the thing. I'm going to put on my UX hat here.
Mm-hmm.
They chose the path of more resistance to decrease user enjoyment, because somebody had to explicitly go in there and say, no, it's in another deck already.
Yeah, that's basically a feature. I mean, I agree. I thought about that as well. It's like the natural programming logic would be to let you use it in as many decks as you want.
Yeah.
So someone actually had to go in and decide to disallow that, which is kind of shocking, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it makes it more realistic, but if I wanted to be realistic, I'd buy paper cards.
Well, let's talk about realism, because this is the world of Pokemon, the trading card game, the video game, essentially is limited to the space of 9 rooms. That is the entirety of Earth.
Well, there's a good comment about this. So this is I call this subtopic cheapness. Metal Guardian, this is over on NeoGAF, Metal Guardian posted, "The very first impression I got from the game was that it felt like a fan-made ROM hack. Everything
That's
about
fair.
The
everything, no, you know, no, I'm gonna accept that.
Everything
totally
about
that.
The structure is aped directly from Red Blue and all subsequent mainline titles, but is executed with far less competency. The most glaring issue
it's
in this vein
what
is,
can you say?
Is the world itself. Pokemon TCG has no coherent sense of place. The main character starts in a lab with a professor because, hey, you guys, remember when the real games did that? Maybe instead of a professor who studies biological species, something that, you know, actually makes sense, you can meet a professor of printed pieces of paper.
Yeah.
Called lexologists.
Hello. Yeah, like that. This was part of a much larger rant, correct?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. It was a completely epic
Metal
post.
Metal Guardian wrote a novel.
Yeah, this was a classically epic post because he pretty much deconstructed the entire game, slammed the art style, slammed the way the rooms are laid out.
I would point out that his issue with PhDs of essentially word on paper.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of wrote a doctoral thesis about this fucking game.
but the sad thing is, we're going through his posts and we're like, yep, check mark.
To me, a lot of it is, there's a lot of reasons why someone might buy a game like this for Game Boy. Or now
they've been drinking.
Yes.
They're ignorant.
Their parents don't know any better.
They're among
mentally
other
incapacitated.
Things,
it was free.
Not free, but cheap. Now think about this. A collectible card game is a very expensive proposition to get into.
Yeah. Yes.
And for a parent, especially, whose kid is asking for a bunch of Pokemon cards for Christmas or their birthday, it's very appealing to say, well, if I just spend $30 on this Game Boy game, it has all the cards in there already.
Yeah.
And they can play as much as they want, and they don't have to – they collect within the game, but they don't have to go around and collect and trade with other people.
So it's kind of like crack as opposed to high-grade cocaine.
No, I don't understand that comparison.
It's like a make-your-own crack kit.
Yeah, sort of. So the video game is kind of like crack, where you get that high, but it's cheap. Whereas the high-grade cocaine from the coca leaf,
basically you take the cocaine and then you heat it up.
Yeah, like the whole cost of a trading card game is the reason why I was not even interested in paying attention when a friend of mine was trying to teach me Magic the Gathering. I was like, okay, thanks for lending me this deck that probably suck, but I'm never going to buy my own, and I'm not really even interested in learning this game.
Here's the thing, though. I don't know that the cost equation works, because it presupposes that parents have any fucking idea what's going on and realize that this isn't a one-time investment on these cards.
Maybe so. The other use case that I can see for something like this to exist, other than for us to, you know, talk about it on Retroactive 15 years later.
That's why they made it.
Is that if you have some interest in the card game, but you want to play with cards that you know you'll probably never get for whatever reason, or if you want to have a practice scenario where you can try to modify your decks more easily, or use cards that you don't already or you don't yet own, or you don't think you're gonna own, or if you have a deck, let's say you have a deck that you made with your paper cards, but you can only play with your friends on the weekends. And you want to be able to practice with it and maybe test it and try, you know, experiment and modify it a little bit during the week. You could recreate it in this game and play against the computer whenever you feel like it, because they're always around. And so for me, I understand the complaints. I mean, yes, if you're going to bother to put in this world and some kind of skeleton of a story and characters, you should probably do a better job of it than is done here. Mm-hmm. But I'll also say, to me, that stuff is so tangential to the core purpose. The reason for this to exist is it's just a card game simulator. And I think as a card game simulator, it functions very well. Now, I have certain strategic issues with the card game itself and with the rules and with the cards that are included here. You know, I mean, I had a lot of fun with it, but I have certain niggles, and, you know, it doesn't compare great to Magic the Gathering for me, which is just a lot deeper and more interesting to me. But I'll say, I mean, I feel like as a simulator of the Pokemon trading card game, this does a really nice job. And all that stuff about the writing of the characters and the graphics and the lack of exploration, to me, is just, yes, all that is true. To me, it's sort of beside the point of the game.
It
didn't take away from my
really.
Enjoyment of it.
Here's the thing,
this really is not an RPG at all. I mean, it looks like one, but it's really not.
More, it's almost a gateway into the actual trading card game, because I mean, I could see somebody saying, you know, I don't want to get into that whole buying thing because I'm not too sure if I actually will like this, but maybe I'll just get this, you know, get the game version of it and try it out to see if I like it.
Yeah.
At all. Like, even the base concept.
I mean, it seems to me, though, that the amount of effort you have to put in to try out different cards and in hopes to even get that card sort of takes away some of the ability to experiment, though. Like, it feels like it would almost be better if you could just do a free play mode. Like, you could just say, like, I just want these cards in my deck right now. I'm going to try them out.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You take out the structure. You know, the idea that you have to grind through. Actually, there's a good comment about this. So Vicious Killer Squirrel, this is also from NeoGaff, posted, said, I like that losing a duel attracted no penalty. It meant that you could take a hard look at what went wrong, readjust your strategy, and just try again. If you figure you should have won but got a bad draw, then it's a simple matter of talking to the opponent again. I didn't like that cards could really only be gotten via random chance. There's no way to buy cards, very few people you could actually trade cards with, and no mechanism apart from the main story for earning specific cards. Mm-hmm. If ever Game Freak decided to make a new game in this series, I'd expect a whole series of side quests to allow this very thing.
Yeah, I mean, you could flesh it out quite a bit. I mean, and also, you know, one of the tricks that people brought up was that you can, you know, save the game. I think it's right before, or like set a restore state right before the winning cards are handed out. So, in other words, when they give you the pack, you can do it because what you get in that pack is basically RNG. So you can sit there and just and win over and over again and just and choose when you get the best cards.
So. Yeah, it's random number generator if you're not in the cool kids club.
Right. I figure that we're probably coming across as pretty negative on the game. I do enjoy playing it. Like, once it clicked, once I understood a little bit better what I was doing, and once I fixed the deck that they gave me, it got more enjoyable. But I've got about 3 badges, so I'm not that far into the game. But also, I think that the grinding gets to me because playing the same, like playing one battle or another battle, it pretty much always comes down to the same thing, right? Unless you wildly vary your own deck every time. Like, the battles are pretty much always going to play out the same. The fact that sometimes you're going to face the same person multiple times, that only makes it worse. So if I were to play it for a longer period of time, I think I could enjoy it. Like, I think, Johnny, you said that you were playing this over your lunch break. At work.
Yes.
And
yes.
I feel like if I could have done that, that would probably have been the optimal way to play, because then it's just like, okay, half an hour, you're done, you put the game away, and then you can play later, like at night or whatever. The way I've had to play it was to kind of binge a little bit, and it gets tedious.
Yeah, sure. If you think about, if you were playing with paper cards, you probably wouldn't play 10 or 15 matches in a row.
Mm-hmm. No.
You'd probably take breaks. I mean, of course, there's another person with you, and so, you know, you have to, you know, be sensitive to their level of interest, I suppose. But, I think one or two battles per session is a good number, especially because they are kind of slow. And that's I'll say again, I actually enjoyed this game quite a bit. I wouldn't say it was a revelation to me, but it was more interesting, more strategic than I expected. And I enjoyed the part that I expected to enjoy, which was tinkering with the decks. I wish that deck editor was a lot better, because if it was, I would have made a lot more decks, and I would have tried to make more specific, narrow-minded special case decks, more tricky decks. I like doing that. I like setting up crazy combos. I like enabling these things that seem like they shouldn't work, but when they do, they're like devastating. This game doesn't really encourage you to do that for a lot of reasons that we've talked about, but I did enjoy taking my Bulbasaur and Friends deck and ripping out all the grass types, putting in a lightning and filling it up with like badass normal monsters and also like a ton of trainer cards and going in and just ripping everything to shreds. I like the feeling that I can go into the gyms and walk straight up to the gym leader and challenge him right off the bat and destroy him and then take my medal and storm out of there. Mm-hmm. Like, cause there's not that much structure to this game. A lot of times you can just go right to whatever you want to do and do it and leave. A lot of the content is optional.
I've hit a lot of roadblocks too doing that, though. The grass leader doesn't show up until you've battled all three other people in that gym, and then you have to fetch her in the card collector the card collector's house, and also the very first gym that I went to, the fighting Pokemon one. Like he says, "Well, my three assistants are traveling the world. You have to find them, battle them, and then come back."
Those are the two most laborious ones. I mean, a lot of them you can just walk into and just go straight up to the
leader. I mean, the biggest issue
like
with the fighting one is you're in this gym and you assume, oh, I'm in the water gym, I'm fine. And you get there and it's all fucking fighting type and you go fight this random rando standing in there. And then you're just getting housed because your deck's completely wrong for the task.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, like once you have accumulated enough cards, it is also pretty fun to, like, against the grass leader, I had the Squirtle and Friends deck. So I had mostly water type. I couldn't really make a dent. Like I couldn't really make progress. So I thought, well, I probably have enough fire type Pokemon at this point that I could create a whole new deck. And that's what I did. And immediately I just trounced that leader. Like, it was like one card just could one hit kill basically all of her Pokemon. Mm. So that was pretty satisfying. And it is a shame that you can't do that more.
So one thing, and I know some of the people in the forum thread mentioned that there's a sequel to this that did not come out of Japan. I think it's called a Revenge of Team Rocket or something like that. I would be very interested to see what the changes are, especially in terms of interface. And the reason I'm thinking along those lines is that when I played many moons ago, I got made fun of a lot for talking about Magic the Gathering Online on this show.
Deservedly so.
It ended up on a t-shirt. But one of the great things about that version is the interface. It's a PC game, so the interface is super customizable. And one of the things you can do to affect the pace of the game is that you can basically set all these stops. So you can tell the game, well, when certain things happen on the opponent's turn, I want you to stop and make sure that I understand what's happening. Give me a chance to respond and play another card if I want to. Or just say okay and let it proceed. Or you can turn those off, which makes the game flow way faster. And especially in this game where you're playing against only computer opponents, I don't even think there is like true multiplayer. Certainly not in the virtual console version, it doesn't have that. So you're only playing against the computer, and because of the rules of Pokemon trading cards, you can't even really do anything on the opponent's turn. I mean, there's nothing you can do to respond. You can't even, you know, even their attacks. I mean, there's nothing. So why is it asking me to like push A 8 times for every time the opponent takes a turn? That's only dragging this whole thing out much, much longer than it needs to be. And I think the game would be more fun if you could at least set options to blast through these battles a lot faster. It's like once I get the basic hang of it, I really don't need to see every single coin flip animate.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
There's a lot of this stuff that I don't need to know that the other character is drawing a card. Now he's thinking. Now he's attaching an energy. Okay, if that's relevant on my turn, I can take however much time I need to go and look at all his Pokemon and see what they are. I don't need you to tell me every single thing that the opponent is doing.
I do wonder if some of that is them hiding processing lag.
Yeah, maybe so. Which again, a sequel would have a chance to do better. Playing this, I have to say, I mean, it kind of piqued my interest. It at least made me wonder, you know, what would a modern version of this look like? What are the changes they would make? How would they use, for instance, the two screens on a 3DS? You know, you could imagine the interface could get much, much better. And, you could see a lot more information at a glance rather than have to go and, you know, sort of tediously check the opponent's play area and look at each one of his cards individually to see which one has energy on it or which one has taken the most damage that you could swap out. So,
yeah, it would probably look a lot like Hearthstone.
Yeah, of course.
Well, actually, like, there is a way, like, this is a thing that exists, right? Like, there is a Pokemon trading card game online, a web browser version.
First I've heard of it.
Really? I've got a friend who's pretty deep into
Is it official?
It seems to be. It's Pokemon.com. Oh, and okay. Of course, like the trading card game scene is still very healthy, and the Pokemon, like they sponsor these tournaments, and I've got a friend who actually, you know, tries to go and compete in them. So it's still a thing, and the game is still evolving. I think that, mm-hmm. of course, they've added a lot more Pokemon to the game just because of the way that there have been so many sequels to the mainline games. But also, I think that the rules have evolved quite a bit.
So yeah, I would imagine so.
I was
because they've added a bunch of types, and that's complicated matters. I was doing some reading on the game as it's evolved since this one came out, because this came out in 98 in Japan, which is a couple of years, about a year and a half after the whole Pokemon thing started there. It came out 2000 here, which is you're starting to butt up against the gold silver era. Yeah. So we have this game that is missing at that time 100 Pokemon. They're just not there. So I was curious how they've sort of evolved the franchise. And, you know, I was looking up the sequel to this game, and it talks about how there's like cards they've had to pull out because of rule changes have rendered them completely unstoppable, or, you know, yeah. it is a more complex game than I think this Game Boy game even at that point could actualize, because you had these sort of like one-off cards. The example that one website gave was that they referred to as the birthday Pikachu, where if it's your birthday, flip a coin, and if it's heads, you do 30 plus 50 damage. The problem is they couldn't verify in tournament settings that it actually was your birthday, because everybody,
well, especially because you've got these people who are not even 16 years old yet, so they don't even have photo IDs.
So everybody who was registering for a tournament, it was always their birthday.
Were they bringing their birth certificate?
Yeah. So that you'd sign up for the tournament, they'd ask what your birthday is, and they'd always put today.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. Just looking at the Pokemon site, what Guillaume was talking about, they have a Windows, a Mac version, and an iPad version that you can download of the Pokemon trading card game.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Was totally unaware of that. Very interesting.
Interesting. Yes. Mm-hmm. Also, I do want to make note, a little bit of trivia. There was a GBA or maybe DS game called Card Hero that was only in Japan, that was seen as a sort of spiritual successor to Pokemon the trading card game, although it was not based on an actual printed card game. It only existed in video game form, but it was a similar setup where you're playing a kid going around challenging people, collecting cards. I don't know how similar the rules are to what you see here in Pokemon, but I believe it was
Card Battle, Card Hero, yes.
Yeah, I believe it was highly regarded, and there was, for a time, a lot of optimism that it would get localized, and it never did. So that's, Nintendo has a series, and I think there probably are a lot of advantages, to separating this concept out from the real Pokemon cards, especially as you described, James, that the real Pokemon cards have gotten very complicated. And, you know, I'm sure the community that still plays them is fairly hardcore. I doubt that they're doing a lot to bring in younger players. I'm sure over time, which has happened a lot with Magic Gathering as well, is that you end up with this kind of core fan base who keeps wanting it to get more sophisticated and more intricate. And it becomes more and more difficult to bring in new people, but maybe that's okay, 'cause the hardcore people spend the most money on it anyway. But something like Card Hero, I feel like could be revived fairly easily, and it's not burdened by this legacy of, you know, over 15 years of the real cards coming out and all the rule changes
and things like that. That was a Intelligent Systems SPD1 game, if I recall correctly.
Ooh, I bet it's really good. I know I was always really curious about it.
I always remember seeing it and thinking, wow, these look like knockoff Pokemon.
Well, yeah, sure.
I mean, it's they look like they look like Spectrobes characters. That's a deep cut if you've never been to E3. If you've been to E3, you just wanted Spectrobes to fucking go away.
Yeah, seriously. Fucking Spectrobes.
Well, I do feel there's one more forum comment that we have to get out here, and it's about a subtopic that hasn't really come up yet, but I bet we all have strong feelings about it. So this one is from Halbred, who is, of course, our friend Zach Miller from Connectivity and lots of other things. So he posted, one thing I should note here about coin flips. You'll notice they're not random.
Nope.
That is, try doing a restore point just before making a coin flip. If you get tails, reset to the store point and try again. It'll be tails again. forever. Why? Because the coin flips are predetermined. The game predetermines all of the coin flips for a match before it begins. Not sure why it wouldn't just randomize the coin flip, but there you go.
What a load of shit.
Well, that is straight bullshit, dude.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Well, hold on. Really what it did was it randomized essentially a set of coin flips.
It's going to create a table of, like, here's the next 100 coin flips that you'll never get to the end.
Yeah, it's almost like a loot drop off of a boss. It's all predetermined.
They're still random, right. And before you had save states, it didn't fucking matter.
Exactly. Right, this is an artifact of Virtual Console that you can even see that this is happening. I bet they did it because whatever random number generator they were using back then was probably processor intensive.
Yep.
And so rather than slow down the game even more to do it every time, they did it all at once and then pulled out the table every time.
Right.
It's probably a programming trick because they don't necessarily
know whose coin flip it's going to be because
exactly.
You're going to end up with some asshole who keeps stunning you, and that's all he does. So there's no damage being done. You'll flip 75 coins in the battle. But
Like, this doesn't prevent you from cheating still, because so many Pokemons have at least two attacks, one of which might have a flip coin, the other might not, so you can test it out. Okay, so I fail if I try this one, I'm going to just do the lesser attack.
I got in a fight with two electric, I had electric type, they had electric type, and we just kept paralyzing each other for no damage.
Right.
And because I was just like, I didn't want to swap because I didn't want to take the penalty. I just wanted him to kill what I had. That went on for 20 minutes of us just paralyzing and coin flipping.
Yeah, this is one reason that I started to take out any cards in my deck that involve coin flips. Mm-hmm. Because I'm kind of aghast that there are so many coin flips in this game. Is this part of the paper cards? Were they asking kids to flip coins like every 5 seconds when they play these card games? It's unbelievable to me that there's this much random chance just in the usage of the cards, not even drawing the card that you want, but even to see whether its attack works or not there's a 50-50 chance. There's no way.
I mean, how could you do that in tournaments? How could you ever strategize with that? Because
it's
you really
just obnoxious,
don't know.
And it slows down the proceeding so much to do a coin flip every time you attack.
It's really the only way that you can add that element of when you do status effects in there, like how long are they going to hold? Because otherwise, you'd have to just say, well, you're poisoned in 6 turns, you're effed.
Or you could give more cards that heal poison. I mean,
there's a lot of ways,
and there's plenty of examples of how other games handle this situation that don't involve freaking coin flips.
I understand why the coin flips are there, and in general, they don't bother me. It's when we get in these chains of just flip, that gets ridiculous.
They kill the pacing of the matches. Mm-hmm. That's my big complaint. I just think they're obnoxious.
What pacing in this game? There isn't any.
Yeah, there is none.
The pacing.
That's a thing. Yeah, but it's like it's two or three different issues that stack on top of each other to make these battles take way longer than they really should. For the complexity of what's going on here, these things could be over way faster. Mm-hmm. And I think the game would be more enjoyable if they were. Again, that's kind of why I'm interested in the sequel and the spiritual successor
to see
if they handle that better.
I would guess. I can't confirm this. I fucking bothered to check, but I would guess that the sequel's been fan translated because there's not a ton of text in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And these cards, I mean, the cards they're using are legit cards, so they could just go look up what the text on the card was.
Yeah.
And they look at the picture, that's a Sneevil. Okay, whatever, I'll go get the fucking text off the card. Done, I'm out. But to that end, I wonder if. So, I mean, Johnny, you were covering games at this point. John, you were as well. I was knee deep in them at this point. This was that stretch where I was getting a game every other week. And there were a lot of card games from 2000-ish to about 2004. Whenever Lost Kingdoms 2 came out. That's probably the point I mark as the end.
Well, at the end, I mean, there was the Tubot and Kaitos games.
Yeah.
There were all the Yu-Gi-Oh!, which those still come out on 3DS.
Yeah, those are like just –
there were Yu-Gi-Oh! Games for – I mean, every year that the DS was out. Yeah.
It was other – like games that weren't tied to a franchise, like just card battle game. There was that weird period where there was a bunch of them.
There, I remember one for Game Boy Color called Magic...
Imagination. No?
Yes, Imagination.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I remember meeting the developers at one of my first E3s and they showed it to me. It had really nice graphics. And yeah, it was a card-based RPG. There was a lot of them. I mean, it was in the period after Pokemon trading cards got big and Magic was big and people were like, hey, we should do this. We should make these video games.
Yeah.
A little Coldcept.
In a way, this game is both a precursor and of an era.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I wonder how much – so Nintendo owns the printing of the cards now. Like they took that on at some point. It's no longer run by Wizards of the Coast. I wonder how much they actually care about that particular arm of the company. I mean, it does make sense that they would be involved. They do have a history in
card
games.
Wait, is it owned by Nintendo or the Pokemon company?
Nintendo runs the card game. It is owned by the Pokemon company. They are the ones who produce the card game. At least they were at one point.
Are they designing the new cards and stuff like that?
I would presume so. Because after Wizards had it, it went to Nintendo, which is weird. But I understand why. You don't cut in. They get two cuts of the money out of it. I can see where they'd want to be involved. But I don't know. I wonder, like, how they view, cause I mean, they do generally host, like, give us point, like, when they're having the Pokemon tournaments is in the game, you know, when they have those tournaments, they'll have, like, the card tournament on the side. So I guess it still matters to someone. I'm curious if they would ever consider making, even if it was a much simpler game, even like to the point of like the app where you just got to battle random opponents. Just to give you that experience on 3DS. Like, what if they just put it on the eShop as a game where it was freemium and you just bought other cards?
Pokemon Shuffle, but with cards.
Yeah, but right. you just buy decks. I don't think they'd ever get to the point where you buy individual specific cards for money. I feel like they would feel like that might be.
Nah, I mean, decks are.
That would really be pay to win.
Yep.
Why not buy booster packs the way Magic Online
does? That's what I'm
thinking.
Yeah. You buy booster packs.
That's what Hearthstone
does.
That shit is lucrative.
Oh, it is lucrative.
I could tell you from hundreds of dollars of experience.
Yeah. That's why I don't play Hearthstone.
It's a lucrative business. Yeah.
I do not play it.
Well, anyway, I thought that was a pretty good discussion. This is certainly a very interesting game. We all had varying levels of fun with it and plenty of criticisms as well. But, geez, it's a very old and very innovative game at the time, so that's not a surprise. But I want to thank everybody who posted in the forums, everybody who played along, everyone who voted in the poll where this was originally selected as the winner. And I hope everyone enjoyed this edition of Retroactive, and we'll try to do another one very soon. We've already started talking about it, actually, I don't want it to be a continuous feature, but we'll take a little bit of time off. But I do want to do it at least a few times every year. So anyway, thanks everybody for participating. Thank you for listening to this show. We will try to do listener mail next week, so you can send us an email about Retroactive or about anything else going on in the world of video games to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And you should also subscribe to the Famicast on iTunes or at our website, NWR, and hear the most recent episode where James was a guest talking about fighting games.
Is that a Famicast?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize they put it in the Famicast feed. It was just
they
a thing
did.
We did.
Well, it's because it's affiliated with Ty.
Yeah, it's a 2-hour experience is probably the way to describe it.
I have not listened to it yet, but I'm eager to do so. So that's Ty Sugard and Addison Webb and James and who else?
Don.
And Don's okay, Don Koopman. So yeah.
3 continents were on that podcast.
Yeah, it's extremely international. So you should check that out over at our friends with the Famicast. Anyway. We'll see you all next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Bye.
Aw, yeah.